It's time for the Scott Rintoul Show.
He holds, he shoots, he scores!
Where the West...
Pettersson up the left wing, steps into a slap shot and scores. Elias Pettersson, oh my word, again.
Is one.
Rebound, Kachuk scores! What a night for Matthew Kachuk.
Let's make it happen. Everything you've got, no excuses.
Jackson avoids, spins, he's in. Touchdown, McCaffrey leaps.
Now, here's Scott Rintoul.
Pull my trigger, let me blow your mind.
What's going on? Happy Friday. We'll get you through it. No casual Friday here. We got a jacked up show for you. We will bring it for you for the next few hours, and we will get you through your day. It'll be faster than you even thought. We've got some breaking news we're going to get on the air here momentarily as the Calgary Flames have updated the status of TJ Brody and given us more of an explanation, though they don't have all the answers right now. We will play that audio for you here momentarily. I do want to roll out the guest list. I'll mention this a couple of times because it's fairly significant. Kelly Olynyk, this timing could not be more perfect for us today. We've been chasing Kelly for a while. Canadian NBAer from Kamloops, BC, playing for the Miami Heat. He just happened to be landed on this day, and it's a day in which Canada finds out that Victoria, BC will host the FIBA Olympic qualifier next June. That's big news. That is a country, and I'm not even sure how the check gets written, but as a sports fan, I don't really care right now. As a sports fan, what I know is this country is putting its best foot forward to give Canada an opportunity to qualify for the Olympics next summer by saying, we'll host this event. It'll be here. You want an opportunity for NBA stars, and yes, in some cases with the Canadian players, we're talking stars, to say, okay, I'll show up. You have provided the best possible opportunity for that. Kelly Olynyk, a guy who always shows up for his country, is going to join us at the bottom of this hour. Want to see what things are like down in South Beach. He didn't hold that same kind of press conference when he decided to go there, by the way. But I want to find out if things are going to Miami, but also his thoughts on Canada stepping up to the plate here and giving him and the rest of his teammates an opportunity to go to the Olympics next summer, the best opportunity to go to the Olympics next summer. Kelly Olynyk at the bottom of this hour, Hockey Hall of Famer Scott Niedermayer. You may have heard of him. His son plays in the BCHL. We'll talk to him a little bit about that, but also his view of the game right now, the young mobile defenseman he's able to watch in the NHL and who might compare to him. Hockey Hall of Famer in the second hour right here on the Scott Rintoul Show. But there were a couple of very scary incidents in sports yesterday. One, completely avoidable. The other, not so much. And it happened in Calgary, and everyone who was there, from the accounts I read, from hearing Peter Loubardius, who was on the air at the time that TJ Brody collapsed on the ice in Calgary, was shaken. It was a very disturbing moment for those who witnessed it yesterday. And TJ Brody was taken to hospital, and we were waiting for clarification of his status this morning. The general manager of the Calgary Flames, Brad Treliving, just took to the podium at the Saddle Dome. Here's what he had to say.
After a few minutes, you know, TJ was alert. He was responsive on the ice. The EMS team, ambulance, arrived and transported him to Foothills Hospital. And he remained there basically for the remainder of the day. Probably into early evening last night, a battery of tests were taking place. And then TJ was released. He was at home last night with his family, rested. I spoke with TJ. I know Ian has spoken with TJ this morning. He's feeling good. He's sore. and like I said, I'll let Ian kind of go into any more detail, but all of the tests that have been done to date have come back negative. He's doing well. This is going to be, we're not going to leave any stone unturned in terms of the tests that we go through. And no set timetable for TJ's return, you know.
So that's great news that we hear at the end, that so far every single test that they've done on TJ Brody has come back negative, as in they don't know the cause right now, but they've been able to at least rule a bunch of stuff out. And I imagine, I'm not a doctor, you know that, but I imagine they start with the most serious stuff and work their way down the checklist. As Brad Treliving said, they are not going to leave any stone unturned here. TJ Brody, very good news that he was released from hospital yesterday, that he was able to spend the night at home with his family, that he's been able to speak with the team this morning, and that he is doing well, whatever that means. But after a serious incident where he collapses on the ice yesterday, goes into what was described as convulsions, is rushed to the hospital via ambulance, good news for TJ Brody. Ian, that you heard Brad Treliving referred to, is one of the doctors with the Calgary Flames, as in Dr. Ian Ault. He was also at the podium, and here's what he had to say as to causation, or at least where they're at trying to figure out how this happened to TJ Brody at practice yesterday.
I think what we can say is, you know, an event like this can be caused by something inside the brain, something scary, and it can also be caused by what we call syncopal or fainting episodes. And the reasons for why people faint are many, and dehydration certainly could be one of them. I don't think we have all the answers yet. We do have a few more tests to go, but all the early indications are that it's very likely more related to a fainting episode than it is to something significant and inside the brain.
I imagine that's still scary for TJ Brody, for his family, for his teammates. What do you mean? A guy could just faint at any moment and go into convulsions. But as opposed to something systemic, something that could reoccur on a regular basis, this sounds like it's heading toward best possible scenario. Now, who knows? Maybe this ends up being a condition that limits TJ Brody's playing career. I have no idea. But everything I heard from Brad Treliving and Dr. Ian Ault on the podium today, at least what they've said so far, sounds more positive than I think people had initially assumed. We don't want to make any rash judgments. As the doctor said there, they're still trying to figure out exactly what happened. But after what was witnessed yesterday, and with the fear that went into his teammates, those in attendance, the organization, his family, this sounds right now like the best possible outcome less than 24 hours later. Any further updates, we will get them to you, but that's the latest on the TJ Brody situation. A scary one yesterday. There was another frightening incident that took place, and this one was completely avoidable, and it happened at the end of the Thursday night football game.
Well, he tackled Rudolph. Rudolph didn't like the way that he was tackled.
Oh, my goodness. Rips the helmet off Rudolph's head and then eventually swings it and hits him in the head.
Final plays of the game. It's not a blowout, but the game has long since been decided. Mason Rudolph in the pocket gets rid of the football. Bit of a scrum ensues with Miles Garrett. He and a couple of guys. Rudolph's going after Garrett a little bit on the ground. Again, Garrett is a defensive lineman. Mason Rudolph's a quarterback. Helmet ripped off by Miles Garrett, and I'm talking about Rudolph's here, and then while they are in a bit of a melee, and there is a lineman that's pushing Garrett at the time, Garrett swings the helmet, hits Rudolph in the head, and then a little bit of hell breaks loose. A couple of linemen go after Garrett. Marquise Pouncey, in particular, from the Steelers, he starts swinging at Garrett. Garrett's on the ground. He tries to kick him, but a Browns teammate kind of gets in between the kick. But Mason Rudolph, without a helmet on, gets hit with his own helmet by Miles Garrett. He has been suspended indefinitely, this just coming down, by the NFL. And this is such an easy slam dunk, no-brainer for this league. And pardon the prompt pun when we're involving a potential head injury here. Although Mason Rudolph said he was fine last night, as fine as you can be after taking your own helmet in the head. Adam Schefter is the one reporting the NFL has suspended Garrett indefinitely. But this is so easy. So easy. This is, you're gone for the rest of the season. Now, that might get walked back upon appeal, but if you're the league, this is simple. We don't allow that. You're gone for the rest of the year. Sit down. If an arbitrator decides to walk that back, so be it. There was a time that I didn't believe the NFL would come down that hard on Myles Garrett. There's people maybe calling for further action against him, as in legal action against him. I doubt it will get to that, but we'll see. Some people are calling for the suspension to extend it to next season. I think this will be a slam dunk. You're gone for the rest of the year. They may appeal that. Garrett may say, I want my reps to take a look. I want an arbitrator. Okay, maybe it gets down to 5 or 4 games. I'm not sure. They've got 6 games left in the season. The Browns are 4-6. This completely overshadows, and understandably so, what was supposed to have been a good night for Cleveland in what has been a bad season for Cleveland. And I will tell you this, despite this brutal spectacle that we saw on the field last night in Ohio, Baker Mayfield had his best moment as a professional, in my opinion. Certainly his best moment of the season. And he's had some great highlights, and he had a lot of fun last year scoring touchdowns. But he had his best moment as a professional after the game. We'll play the audio for you a little later on in the show. But Mayfield, during his on-field interview with Aaron Andrews, you know what? Let's dial it up here. We'll play it in the second hour as well. I think it's important for you to hear this. This comes from a teammate. You know what teammates usually do. They get their teammates back. Mayfield didn't do that.
It's inexcusable. I don't care, rivalry or not. We can't do that. That's kind of the history of, you know, what's been going on here lately, hurting yourself. And that's just endangering the other team. That's inexcusable. He knows that. I hope he does now. It's tough. We'll see.
Mason Rudolph, a friend of yours, Myles Garrett, a teammate of yours. What were you saying to your teammates over there to kind of calm everybody down?
I don't think there's anything in that moment that I can really say to calm him down. You know what? The reality is he's going to get suspended. We don't know how long, and that hurts our team. And we can't do that. We can't continue to hurt this team. That's inexcusable.
And that wasn't the only incident in the game last night. Certainly nothing else like this, but there were other guys who took major infractions. Juju Smith-Schuster had a concussion last night. Other players were knocked out of the game, including Deontay Johnson on a headshot. This is an undisciplined team. Very undisciplined team. Nobody would expect this on any club, what happened with Myles Garrett, but it is symbolic to a certain extent of the way the Browns have been run this year. The guys just decide to step over the line. They take turns doing it in Cleveland. And that is the biggest condemnation of what they've been this year. That they're a little bit out of control. Not to this extent. I'm not going to blame Myles Garrett swinging a helmet at Mason Rudolph on Freddie Kitchens. But this is a team that has been undisciplined since day one. And it hasn't really cleaned itself up. They don't fall in line. There's not complete buy-in. That's not what they are in Cleveland, and that needs to change. I wish we had a better backdrop to lead you into the six-pack for the weekend, but let's tee you up for a half dozen games that are going to be going on this Sunday.
Here's the thing about the future. Every time you look at it changes because you looked at it. And that changes everything.
What better way than to start with Nick Cage, right? Two guys changing the NFL's future take center stage in Baltimore this weekend. Deshaun Watson, Lamar Jackson going head-to-head, arm-to-arm, and legs-to-legs. While they go about their business in different manners, both Watson and Jackson, a threat to do something you've never seen before every single time they have the ball.
It's a second down and 3. Jackson takes it himself. Look at him turn back and forth. Oh! He broke his ankles! Now he's got an entourage! And he's got a touchdown! He is Houdini! What a play! 47-yard touchdown run by the magical quarterback, Lamar Jackson.
Yeah, that's Lamar Jackson, who has the better supporting cast along the ground in this game. Deshaun Watson, the superior weapons to work with through the air. While the 6-3 Texans aren't getting the love they deserve because of their previous playoff failures, the Ravens are rolling and everyone is taking notice. Baltimore has won 5 straight. That includes victories over New England and Seattle. That's an impressive run, led by a man who makes impressive runs every single weekend. But Houston plays the run well, and while there's no obvious antidote to defending Jackson's legs, the Ravens may want to rely on his arm given how Houston struggles in the secondary. This sets up as a shootout between Watson and Jackson in Baltimore, a place the Texans have never won in 4 previous trips to Maryland. to a divisional duel in Carolina where all of the questions are about the team the Panthers have to play.
Ready, set. Third and four. Four-man rush. Breeze pumps in trouble, and he's sacked again. Adrian Claiborne got the sack.
That's a taste of what the Falcons looked like last weekend, slamming the Saints. But for the most part, Atlanta's D's looked like this.
Third down and five as Watson sets and now throws. It's Fuller. Will Fuller into the end zone. His third touchdown today.
So which Falcons team shows up to play the Panthers? I have no idea defensively. But I can tell you this. The offense will be without a couple of key pieces. Devonta Freeman, Austin Hooper as well. He leads the league in touchdowns among tight ends. Conversely, Carolina very consistent. Christian McCaffrey is going to score. He has a rushing touchdown in seven straight games. The Panthers are going to sack the quarterback. They lead the NFL in that category with 36. But the Panthers have been porous against the run of late, and Matt Ryan has won six of his last seven against Carolina, throwing 15 touchdowns to just three picks in those seven starts.
I'd say that's one of the bigger things that we're lacking right now offensively is that fast start.
That's not the only thing that was lacking for Drew Brees and the Saints offense last weekend, but it finally caught up with them. Despite a 7-2 start to the season, the Saints' starts rank among the worst in the NFL. New Orleans has scored just one touchdown in the first quarter all year long, and they have a collective 3 points on their nine opening drives. Good news, however, this week's opposition offers little to no resistance in the secondary. Tampa Bay is the NFL's worst pass defense, which is music to the ears of the NFL's leading receiver, Michael Thomas. But the Bucs boast two of the league's top four pass catchers in Mike Evans and Chris Godwin, so as long as Jameis Winston is throwing ball to them and not the opposing defense.
Winston throws, and it's picked off! The first pass of the game is intercepted by James Bradberry.
The Saints don't take the ball away often, but Winston might pump those numbers up. He has thrown a league-leading 14 interceptions this season, and if that trend continues, the Saints will almost certainly go marching out of Tampa with their eighth win.
Don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Incredible Hulk reference. I love it. He rarely smiles anyway, but the Bill Belichick scowl, that reaches a different level on the rare occasions in which the Patriots lose. And he's had 2 weeks to stew on this one thanks to a bye following the Pats' lone setback this season. They lost to the Ravens. The combo of Belichick and Brady is 13-4 all-time after a bye. That's actually not as dominant as I expected, quite frankly. But this is more about getting New England's offense going than historical stats. Going no huddle, up tempo, seem to get them in rhythm against Baltimore. So it's very reasonable to think they speed things up against the Eagles, who are also coming off a bye, during which they probably thought about this a few times.
And for the Philadelphia Eagles, the long drought is over. Finally.
Yes, it's the first meeting between the Eagles and the Patriots since the Winged Ones won the Super Bowl 21 months ago. But Philly has a lot of work to do if they want to get back. Currently tied atop the NFC East at 5-4, the Eagles' best chance to pound the Pats would appear to be the ground game. New England has struggled to stun the run while Philly's two-back attack of Jordan Howard and Miles Sanders, that started to roll of late. But whether running or passing, the Eagles will be challenged to protect the ball. New England leads the league with 27 takeaways and usually turns those turnovers into points.
Hi, everybody!
Hi, Dr. Nick!
Yes, Nick is back from the doctor and ready to resume his quarterbacking duties in Indy where the Jags visit the Colts. Nick Foles, he hasn't made it through a full game in Jacksonville uniform yet, but he'll try to do so against the coach who helped guide him to a Super Bowl win and an MVP. Colts bench boss Frank Reich, he was Foles' offensive coordinator in Philly, but he's more concerned with getting his own pivot back this weekend.
Brissett looks both ways. Quick pass, that's complete. Going for the end zone is Zach Pascal for the touchdown.
Those good times were had when Jacoby Brissett was healthy, and that's something he hasn't been for the past couple of games, which have both been losses for the Colts. Brissett should be behind center come Sunday, but he won't have his main man, T.Y. Hilton, returning with him. That'll make cracking the code on a jacked-up Jags D a little more difficult, but Indy would rather this one didn't come down to kicking field goals. It sounds strange to say it when you consider Colts kicker is Adam Vinatieri, but Father Time appears to have impacted his accuracy. The GOAT of upright splitters, he's hit less than 74% of his three-pointers this season, and he's connected on just 70% of his converts.
You're not even looking at the problem.
We're very aware of the problem.
Okay, good. What's the problem?
Well, the problem is a lack of wins for both the Bears and the Rams with little margin for error if either plans on participating in the postseason. At 4-5, Chicago needs to either run the table or come very close to doing so, but an inability to produce points presents a major impediment. That handicap is likely enhanced against a Rams defense that is much improved since acquiring Jalen Ramsey. LA has allowed a total of 37 points against in the last three games. That's since Ramsey arrived, but has only won two of those since the offense went into the tank against the Steelers.
Goff in trouble. Coming out of there with it. Incomplete. Are they going to call that a score and a fumble? Minka Fitzpatrick picked up the football and took it into the end zone.
And account it. Jared Goff has looked nothing like the guy who led his Rams to a Super Bowl last season. Goff enters Week 11 with more turnovers than touchdowns in 2019, and he'll once again be without the services of receiver Brandon Cooks. That's no bueno against a Bears D that snuffed out a far more potent Rams offense when these clubs last clashed in Chicago last year, but maybe the warmer weather will heat up both of these anemic offenses. Let's hope so, or we'll be stuck watching what is shaping up to be a field goal kicking contest, much to the dismay of Sean McVay and his counterpart, Matt Nagy. That is your six-pack for the weekend in the NFL. As mentioned, a very busy show here on the Friday. We got you the update on TJ Brody. If you weren't able to join us at the top of the show, Brad Treliving, Dr. Ian Auld saying that right now things looking positive. Tests have all come back negative at this point. TJ Brody, if you didn't hear this last night, left the hospital, spent the night at home with his family, has been in conversation with the Flames this morning, and things are trending very much in the right direction. The other big news that's coming down, Myles Garrett suspended indefinitely for his helmet-swinging incident at the end of last night's Browns-Steelers matchup. Man, we haven't even got to what McDavid and Dreisaitl did last night. That may pain you to hear, but if you are a hockey fan, you had to watch that. And I will provide you with some context on what they are doing and where this might be headed a little later on in the show. But I'll say this for now. It is becoming more and more difficult to deny the fact the Edmonton Oilers are going to be there for a lot longer than you thought. They just keep putting points in the bank. Yeah, the depth, we all still question it. Bottom line, they keep winning games. They keep leading the division. And those two guys in particular keep crushing it on the score sheet after combining for 11 points last night. But coming up next, big news this morning. Canada is going to host an Olympic men's qualifying basketball tournament in Victoria at the end of June. Kelly Olynyk expected to be a part of Canada's team. He will join us next right here on the Scott Rintoul Show.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show.
Long two. It's good. Miami in front. Olynyk. A 12-point fourth quarter for Olynyk.
Little tee up for our next guest, Kelly Olynyk, slated to join us in just a couple minutes' time here on the Scott Rintoul Show. He of the Miami Heat. More on that in just 1 second. I do want to update you on the suspensions that have gone on in the NFL. It's not just Myles Garrett, who has been suspended for at least the rest of the regular season and postseason. Postseason, assuming Cleveland were to win out and find a way into the playoffs, which is highly unlikely. So this is probably the rest of the regular season, and it's indefinitely beyond that. That's the big suspension coming down. Marquise Pouncey is also going to get himself a 3-game suspension. He was the stealer that was involved. He was the guy that came to the defense most prominently of Mason Rudolph after Garrett swung the helmet at the Steelers quarterback. And Pouncey was the guy throwing punches. He was the guy who tried to kick Garrett when he was on the ground. He's been given a 3-game suspension, which in both of these cases, they can appeal this. He's been fined as well. And then Larry Ogunjobi. Has been suspended 1 game and fined as well. He's the D lineman from the Browns who also got involved with the fracas as well. So there's 3 suspensions coming down. Maybe Mason Rudolph gets fined out of this as well. But the big one is Myles Garrett. Gone the rest of the year at least. And then there has to be a conversation about reinstatement for 2020. Those are the suspensions coming out of the melee that occurred at the end of Thursday night football. As mentioned, we're going to turn our attention to basketball here. Kelly Olynyk set to join us in just a couple minutes' time. I grew up in Kamloops, British Columbia, and there is zero chance when I was growing up that I thought we were going to have an extremely prominent Canadian in the NBA. But when I was in grade 12, I vividly remember watching Steve Nash in his freshman season at Santa Clara. Skinny, frail Steve Nash hitting 6 free throws at the end of a massive upset in the NCAA tournament. Many of you probably watched it as well. I was glued to my TV. I was riveted. I could not believe that there was a guy from my own province who was in a big-time NCAA game and upsetting the number 2 Arizona Wildcats at the time. It was thrilling. It was captivating. I will never forget that moment. And I was ecstatic when Steve Nash got drafted. Wow, a guy from my own province gets drafted to the NBA. Nobody thought he was going to be a 2-time MVP. Nobody thought he was going to be a Hall of Famer. But that's what he ended up doing. So there is zero chance that I thought at that time a guy from my hometown, a guy who would end up going to the same high school I went to, I think we can call it his high school, by the way, Kelly Olynyk, would get drafted to the NBA in 2013. But that's how far Canadian basketball has come in that time. And you look at what Canada stepped up and did today. News coming out this morning that this country has footed the bill. We don't know exactly what the cost is, but it's multi-million dollars. Canada's going to host a FIBA Men's Olympic qualifying tournament at the end of June next year in Victoria, BC. Here's what that means. And there are 3 other countries that have said we're hosting as well. That got announced today. Lithuania, Croatia, and Serbia are also hosting. If you know anything about international basketball, those are strong nations. So here's the good news. While we don't know every team that's going to be in this 16 pool that Canada will host next June, those 3 won't be there. So that's good news of sorts. This is going to be a very difficult tournament. To get into the Olympics, which takes place a month after this tournament goes in late June, you got to win it. You got to win this tournament, but they're playing it at home. They're playing it on this continent, and they are eliminating almost every excuse you could possibly have if you're a Canadian NBA player, a prominent Canadian baller who is under consideration to play for our country. I imagine the rest of you were disappointed like I was last summer when most guys said can't be there. Now, there were some injuries along the way, and our next guest is one of the guys who was injured at the time. Kelly Olynyk always shows up for this country. Always. And maybe he's not as high profile as Andrew Wiggins or Jamal Murray or some of the other great young players we have coming, RJ Barrett, but Kelly Olynyk, especially on the international basketball stage, very important to this country's success. But he always shows up. Other guys have not always done the same. And I understand when the tournament is in Asia last year and maybe you've got an injury here or there, why you can't go, or maybe you got a contract situation you're worried about. It's disappointing, more understandable. That excuse seems to be eliminated right here to me. This is as good as it is going to get. As good an opportunity as it's going to get to lure as many potential high-end players as possible to join this team. And that's something we will talk to Kelly about here momentarily. He's just calling in as we speak. 7 years now he's been in the NBA. Great stuff. As mentioned, there is zero chance, I thought, growing up in Kamloops, BC, that a guy from my hometown would find a way to play in the best basketball league on the planet, let alone get drafted in the first round. But Kelly Olynyk did just that. It's his 3rd year in Miami. He took his talents to South Beach. Mm-hmm. Kelly Olynyk joining me now. Kelly, always great to catch up with you. How are you doing this morning?
Good, man. Yourself?
I'm doing very well, and I wonder how buoyed you are by the news that came out this morning that Canada is going to host one of FIBA's Olympic qualifying events in June in Victoria, in your home province. Kelly, what does that opportunity mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's phenomenal. You know, unbelievable opportunity for, you know, not only me, but, you know, Canada basketball, you know, as a whole. And just to, you know, great to see, you know, to bring that kind of level of basketball, you know, into Canada for, you know, back into Canada. And it's just, you know, unbelievable opportunity. And, you know, it'll be a great for, you know, players, fans, and, you know, the basketball community alike.
I don't know who stroked the check, but what does it say to you about Basketball Canada and its conviction about what this country might be able to do in the Olympics, that it stepped up to the plate here?
Yeah, definitely stepped up to the plate. And, you know, just, you know, the commitment they, you know, they've now put out. And, you know, we got to match that commitment as, you know, players and a team, and, you know, go out there and do our jobs.
As you mentioned, you got to match the commitment as players. I know you would have been there had you not been injured in the summer. How gutting was that for you, Kelly, to not participate in that tournament, which allowed Canada an opportunity at that time to try to qualify for next summer's Olympics?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, it's tough, especially when one of your goals is to, you know, to play in the Olympics, you know, a life goal, a basketball goal, and, you know, to see these opportunities pass by the wayside, it's tough. I mean, we've been right there, you know, a few times, and, you know, just haven't quite got over that hill. And, you know, obviously it would have been there had I been healthy. Unfortunately, I got, you know, hurt, you know, trying to prepare for that tournament. And, no, it's tough, but, you know, you got to, you know, do what you can. And whenever you're available, you know, give it your all.
Kelly Olynyk, in his seventh year in the NBA, he of the Miami Heat. He joins me here on the Scott Rintoul Show. Back to the injury for a second. As you mentioned, you got injured trying to get ready for the tournament. How are you physically right now?
I'm getting there. You know, obviously not, you know, fully 100%, but I'm definitely, you know, working my way back. I mean, I was out a, you know, a long time, you know, 2.5, almost 3 months. So, you know, it takes a little time to get back in the swing of things, but, you know, I'm back playing now, 11 games into the season. You know, our team's playing unbelievable, you know, playing great, 8-3 right now. So, you know, for us, it's all about continuing to build. And, you know, for me, just, you know, trying to keep building, keep getting stronger, keep getting better, and, you know, make sure I'm healthy when the season gets into full swing here.
I do want to get back to the Miami Heat in a second, but a little more on Canada basketball. In seeing you go out every time you're physically able, hearing you this morning talk about the commitment to the program, where does that come from, Kelly? Is that just the way you were raised? Did you have a passion for Canada basketball from a young age? Where does that motivation for you come from?
Yeah, definitely the way I was raised. You know, I think, you know, my dad was involved in the national teams. You know, I come from a basketball family, and, you know, just having that opportunity when I was young and, you know, watching those guys play. You know, I remember watching, you know, Steve and Canada in the Sydney Olympics in, what was it, 2000, you know, in my living room with my dad and my family, and, you know, being like, you know, I want to do that someday. And, you know, just having been a part of it, you know, it's something that, you know, there's not a lot of ways that you can make a difference and truly give back to your country and the place that, you know, that raised you and brought you up and gave you the opportunities to live a wonderful, successful life. And, you know, playing for your country and, you know, wearing those colors and Canada across your chest with pride is one of those ways that I'm able to do it. So when I have that opportunity, I don't shy away.
Not every Canadian has shown up as often as you. How disappointed are you when that happens? Or do you understand that each situation is unique?
Each situation is definitely unique. I mean, whether you're nursing injuries or, you know, your career or your contracts are at stake or your whatever, sometimes there's other, you know, factors that play into it, whether it's, you know, family stuff or, you know, different stuff that's going on. You know, everybody, you know, has their rhymes and reasons. And I think for some guys, it means a little more. And for other guys that they, you know, they have to take care of other stuff first. And I don't hate on them or, get on them for not playing, because people have their reasons and, you know, they're entitled to those.
Kelly Olynyk, Canadian basketball player with the Miami Heat, joins us here on the Scott Rintoul Show. How close is the Canadian fraternity in the NBA?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely close. There's a bunch, you know, a lot of guys now in the NBA, and there's a bunch of young guys coming up who are now getting in this league and this association and making some noise. And it's amazing to see. You know, when I got drafted, it was, you know, there's like maybe like a few of us, you know, a handful of us. But it's grown and grown and grown, and it's unbelievable to see, know where it's come from, you know, where it's going to, and you know, it's just going to keep getting better. I mean, there's talent coming out of Canada, you know, by the dozens, and you know, these guys are legit top talents in college basketball, in high school first, and then college basketball, and then you know, now you're seeing guys make serious noise in the NBA.
So today's news, and I'm not sure if you knew about this before the news came down today about Canada hosting this tournament. Will that cause you to text some of the guys that you might be playing with? Will this be a big deal among Canadian NBAers?
No, I think it definitely makes it easier to play. No, it's hard. Like, I mean, this last summer, you had to, whatever, like a 30-hour trip to Australia and then flying all over Australia and then going to China. It's taxing, you know, especially when you're getting back 3 days before training camp starts. And then you're going into training camp and then, you know, starting an NBA season. You know, it's not easy. And, you know, I think with that tournament in Canada, you know, we can stay in Canada, train in Canada. You know where you're staying is a good place. You know, with the food you're eating is going to be all right with your body and your system. You know, you can get your workouts in or whatever. It's easier for, you know, NBA teams to send some guys up to keep tabs on you and help you with whatever they need from their side. It just makes it you know, a more streamlined, seamless process. And you know, I knew there was an opportunity that it would be there, but you know, we've heard mumblings that there was opportunities that other, you know, tournaments would be in Canada too, and they didn't come to fruition. So whatever it was that made this one, you know, come to life, you know, I'm super grateful. And you know, my only hope and wish is that, you know, I'm healthy and ready enough to, you know, to step out there and make sure that we get to Tokyo.
Seventh year center / forward in the NBA with the Miami Heat, Kelly Olynyk, joining me on the Scott Rintoul Show. This has been a good few months in Canada for basketball, despite what happened in that Olympic qualifier over the course of the summer. Obviously, the news today, there was the NBA draft that saw multiple Canadians selected, led by RJ Barrett to the Knicks, and the Raptors championship run, which saw droves of people consume it in very public manners across this country. How did the Raptors championship run resonate with you, Kelly?
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously, you know, playing in the NBA and, you know, playing against the Raptors, I mean, if anybody wins a championship, we want it to be us. You know, we want it to be the Miami Heat. But, you know, for that city and that country, you know, and growing up watching, you know, basketball in that city and that country, you know, it's cool. It's cool to see. You know, it's special to see. And, you know, just the excitement, you know, how much it meant to the people. And it's different when, you know, you have a, you know, a team like, you know, Miami or a team in Texas or California or somewhere where there's like three, four, five teams, maybe sometimes in a state. I mean, in Canada, you have, you know, the Toronto Raptors in Toronto, but, you know, you have a whole country behind them. And it was a pretty cool thing to see the whole country rally and the whole country get behind it. And, you know, that sent, you know, shockwaves and you know, uplifted and you know, inspired and made a difference for, you know, a whole country, you know, of people, which is really, really cool, really special to see. And, you know, I think, you know, that's the thing that, you know, could inspire, you know, a young kid to, you know, dare I say it, turn from hockey and start a path to basketball.
Yeah, it's very true. You're right. Steve Nash, look what he did. Look what Vince Carter did. Now you have this Raptors championship run. Did it even surprise you how many people showed so much interest in basketball in this country just a few months ago?
Yeah. You know, you always knew that basketball was growing. You know, it was growing and growing ever since, you know, even from when I was a kid. You know, you can see how much it's changed and how much more of a following and how much more it means to people. And it's really becoming a, you know, a sport that's talked about and watched and followed and, you know, played on multiple levels in Canada. And to see that is really cool. But, you know, even going, you know, obviously living in BC and going as far back, you know, back to, you know, to visit friends and family, you know, even in Kamloops and, you know, small towns, whatever that is for, I don't even know how far it is, 3,000 miles away. you see the excitement for the Raptors, people following, tuning into every game. And it's cool to see, and it's fun. And to have that, that excitement around the game is never a bad thing.
Kelly Olynyk's Miami Heat, 8-3 out of the gate, sitting second in the Eastern Conference in the NBA right now. He joins me on the Scott Rintoul Show. On that run, they knocked off the Sixers, who had Jimmy Butler showing up big time for them in the playoffs last year. Now he's with you down in Miami. What impact has he had on your Miami Heat team?
He's been unbelievable, right from the jump, day one. Unbelievable leader, just plays basketball the right way. Super competitive, brings the best out of everybody here. And, he's been not only a leader, with his play, but, his lifestyle on and off the court, how he takes care of himself, how hard he works. He's been great for our team, and I think that he's really a key cog that's made us get off to this great start.
Well, and you guys were looking to replace a lot of leadership with Dwayne Wade. You spent the last two seasons with him prior to this year. What was it like playing with a future Hall of Famer?
Yeah, it was awesome. You learn so much from those guys. Just how much experience they've had. Obviously, D. Wade won 3 championships. Countless All Stars, countless accolades, and he knew what this league is about, and he knew how to go about it. And he was an instrumental piece in just helping share pass along his knowledge. And he wasn't afraid to do that. He wanted to help. He wanted to help people learn, get better. And, that's what he did. And, he did it really well. And, I was blessed and lucky to be able to play, almost 2 seasons with him. And, watch him go out. And it was fun to be a part of and, have a front row seat to it all.
Those are the kind of guys you dream about playing with when you're growing up watching basketball in Kamloops. I know you've been in the league a long time now. It's fairly commonplace to see a star every time you roll out there. But when you were first getting going in the NBA, did you have one of those starstruck moments with any player? Like, oh my God, I'm on the court with this guy?
Yes and no. I mean, you're out there, you're on the court with the guys. Especially when you're first on the court with Vince Carter, you're watching him play in Toronto so much. Then you're like, damn, I'm really, really here. But after the first few games, it's like there's guys every single night. You're playing against them every single night. And it just becomes commonplace, which is kind of crazy to say coming from Kamloops. But that's the life now.
What about LeBron James? Do you remember the first time you played him? What do you remember about that game?
Yeah, he was in Miami actually when I first came to the league. And it was him, D. Wade, Chris Bosh. I remember when we came down here my rookie year, we actually beat them on a buzzer beater by Jeff Green. I set a screen for Jeff Green and he hit a buzzer beater. That was like my first memory of playing the big three.
Man, you're creating so many more memories along the way. Continued success in the NBA, Kelly. And I know that this country, this province, everybody is fired up with the news today that we can watch you and your fellow Canadian teammates hopefully grab a spot in next summer's Olympics in Victoria.
Appreciate it. I expect to see y'all off Kamloops down in Victoria in the summer.
That's right. South Cam KSS, we're going to represent, man. That's what we're going to do.
Let's get it.
I like it.
All
thanks,
right.
Kelly.
Take care, man.
That's Kelly Olynyk. Great stuff with him, and you heard him say it during the course of the interview. He can't make the decision for his teammates. I think it bleeds through the radio how much he cares about representing this country and how much this means to him, and he just wants to be healthy enough to compete for this country next summer. It's a big deal to him. It's a big deal for Basketball Canada. He can't make the decision for his teammates, but you heard him say it in that interview. This makes it a lot easier to play. This makes it a lot easier to play. You know exactly how the setup's going to be. You don't have to leave the continent. It's not about big travel anymore. And you're playing at home. When are you ever going to get this opportunity again? Everybody understands if you're injured. If you're legitimately injured, people get that. And they're disappointed, but they understand. If it's something other than that, And yes, there are certain personal situations, of course, that any of us would empathize with. You have something big go down in your family, something that is far bigger than your job or the sport that you love to play. Of course, people can understand that. Beyond that, it's going to be tough. It's going to be really tough for people to understand if some of the players that this country will depend on to clinch an Olympic berth next summer decline the opportunity. If it's beyond one of those two reasons, I just hope everybody shows up. Because the opportunity is not going to get any better than this. And good on Basketball Canada. This is almost a challenge of sorts. We will step up. Now it's your turn. You step up. Hopefully more people follow the lead of Kelly Olynyk and step up as well. Good interview with him. More to come. Hockey Hall of Famer Scott Niedermeyer in the way in the second hour. That's coming up on the Scott Rintoul Show.
Ramping up, so definitely no time to get complacent. Like, we definitely got to continue to improve and be better as a group.
As for tonight, five games on the schedule, including the Habs up against Alex Ovechkin and the Capitals. United by Sport. It's time for the Scott Rintoul Show on the home of Vancouver hockey. Sportsnet 650.
Welcome to the Scott Rintoul Show.
This guy goes on, and I have my list of fearless general managers, and your guy is there. I'm going to wonder if he's going to look to do something. Tree Living is not afraid, and the more this goes on, the more I think he will try to shake them up.
That's the voice of Elliot Friedman talking to the guys on Sportsnet 960 this morning. Scott Rintoul, this is the Scott Rintoul Show. And they were talking about where the Flames reside in the Pacific right now. And this is a team that, much like the Sharks and Golden Knights, had high expectations for where they would finish in this division this year. And right now, a little middling. I'm not sure Vegas is panicking. I'm not sure Calgary is panicking. The Sharks, maybe they're panicking a little. Won their fifth straight last night, by the way. While we've all written off San Jose, they're no good anymore. Look at the start. Goaltending's not good enough. All of a sudden, San Jose has won five straight, and they're starting to go Dallas on this situation a little bit. Didn't dig as deep of a hole to climb out of, but the Stars just rolled into Western Canada, took care of business in Calgary, took care of business in Vancouver on consecutive nights, and all of a sudden, Dallas is two games over 500, going 9-1-1 in its last 11 games. San Jose, just one game back of that, what has been an elusive 500 mark for that team early in the season. 9-10-1 right now. And things get a little tighter. Beat the Ducks, who are sitting there right on 500. I don't think most of us believed Anaheim would be in the fight in the Pacific Division for the duration, but they look like a team that's taking a step, starting to incorporate more youth into their system and just be a little tougher out than they were certainly last season. But now the Sharks starting to play the way back into the mix. Coyotes lost last night. Canucks lost last night. But guess who won? Edmonton Oilers. More on them in just a second. And what a night it was for Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl. But I found that interesting from Elliot Friedman. And it does speak to the expectation in Calgary this year. And he went on to say in that interview, and if you want to listen to it, sportsnet.ca/960. If you want to hear everything Friedman had to say today, talked a lot about the Islanders, what's going on there, certainly talked about the Flames, and zipped around the Ilya Kovalchuk situation as well. But Friedman said it's not easy to make deals right now, and I'm not telling you that it's imminent, but he just gets the sense that Brad Treliving's the kind of guy who looks at this, sees a team that hasn't been able to win more than two in a row, despite not having lost more than two in a row on the other side of it, and says, maybe we need to change something just a little. Maybe we need to tweak things here. And Friedman said, and this was all speculation, he said, might not even be the biggest deal in the world. Might just be a little something. Might just be a slight change. But that's the sense he gets in Calgary. I'm not sure there's other teams in the Pacific Division that feel the same, but maybe Brad Treliving sees something just a little wrong and something that needs a minor shakeup, or maybe it's bigger than that. We'll see as this goes. As mentioned, the Edmonton Oilers continue to roll. 13-6-2. And yeah, I've been among the deniers I've been among those, and probably most of you are with me, saying they're just not deep enough. This can't continue. And maybe it can't. We've seen teams have great first halves, and then you've played the wheels off your top players. They're out of gas. The secondary scoring never shows up. And we know how that ends. So maybe that's what happens to the Edmonton Oilers. But Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, the last two or three games, starting to go a little bit now. Getting a little more secondary scoring, though they didn't need it last night. You want to talk stark contrast for Adam Werner? Kid gets thrown in there for the Avalanche 2 games ago because the starter gets run over, quite literally. Just run over in that game. And he goes in and he stops all 40 shots he sees, and his NHL debut is a shared shutout, 4-0 for the Avs. Then last night he goes and sees two of the best in the biz, and they pumped him pretty good. Pucks going in at an alarming rate for the Colorado Avalanche last night. 6-2, Oilers win that game. And what about McDavid and what about Draisaitl? 11 points combined, hat trick and a six-pack for Connor McDavid last night. Draisaitl with a handful of apples in that game. These two guys are at a blistering pace right now. Blistering. Draisaitl leads the league with 41 points in 21 games. You don't have to be a mathematician to figure out that's approximately 2 points a game. McDavid, he's second with 37. And a good bet at some point along the way to probably overtake Draisaitl, though the rate the two guys are going, who knows. Just to put that in perspective, we saw Nikita Kucherov have a season that we haven't seen in a really long time. He had 128 points last year. Now, this is about the time that Kucherov really started to roll last year and kept it up, but he didn't get off to a start that looked anything like this. Nothing like this. Through 21 games last year, Nikita Kucherov had 24 points. Now, he played on a far deeper team. He played on basically an all-star team during the regular season last year. McDavid and Draisaitl, they don't have that luxury. But that power play continues to roll. Those guys are confident right now, and winning does funny things. I'm going to give you just some context because it's allowed us to at least have this conversation, and maybe you think, nah, the pace dries up way too much. But is it unreasonable right now to throw the benchmark of 140? Could either guy get to 140 points this year? That means from here on in, the next 61 games, for Leon Draisaitl, he's got to put up 100 points. It's pretty productive. It's not easy to do, but is it completely unreasonable? I'm not sure it is. 130, that seems somewhat achievable as well. And Kucherov almost got there. And the difference is this. Not only did Kucherov play on a much deeper team, they didn't have to play desperate hockey at the end of last year. Now, they kept those guys out there, and Kucherov kept putting up the points. But they weren't a team that had to push. And as well as things have gone for the Edmonton Oilers, you don't get the sense they're going to run away from anybody. They're not that good. As well as things have gone, they're not going to run away from the rest of the Pacific Division. So these guys are going to have to push. They might run out of gas. The big minutes might tax them later in the season. And we do expect this type of pace to slow down. But could they take a legitimate run at 130, 140? Fair questions to be asking right now with Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl. Just to give you an idea, there are only 9 players in the history of the NHL who've hit 140 points. That's it. Some guys have done it multiple times on the other side of that, but only 9 guys ever have gotten there. 23 players ever have reached 130 or more. So we're talking about a pretty select group. Kucherov came close to joining them last year, wasn't able to quite get there. But this is the type of pace these guys are on. Incredible stuff to watch last night. That highlight pack. McDavid had 6 points through 2 periods. Took the third period off, basically, last night. That's the first time, and you think of those Oilers heydays, that's the first time an Edmonton Oilers had 6 points through 40 minutes since 1986. Game not quite the same. Goaltending just slightly better, with all due respect to Adam Werner last night. It's just slightly better now than it was in 1986 when goals were going in all over the place. Impressive stuff to watch last night. Busy night in the NHL. And as mentioned, all of a sudden, those Sharks, 5 straight wins, they're not there yet. But this continues. All of a sudden, we're going to group them in. They're still 9 points back of Edmonton. Edmonton free and clear by 4 points right now in the division. See how this continues. So much to get to right now in the world of sports. So much happened last night. A lot of people commenting on a variety of subjects. So let's get to what we do every day around this time. Let's get to what they're saying.
Bro, what are you talking about, man?
What are you saying?
Not saying anything.
You're saying something?
I guess that's what I'm saying, Brooksy.
Here's what they're saying.
A couple of very big incidents yesterday. One of them involving Calgary Flames defenseman TJ Brody, who collapsed at practice in Calgary yesterday, went into convulsions on the ice. That's what those in attendance described them as. Had to get medical help getting off, stretcher, out of there, into an ambulance. Had to go to the hospital. Everybody wanted to know what the update was. Pretty frightening incident for everybody in attendance. The general manager of the Calgary Flames, Brad Treliving, was among those who took to the podium. He had a press conference this morning. Here's what he had to say in updating TJ Brody's situation.
After a few minutes, you know, TJ was alert. He was responsive on the ice. The EMS team ambulance arrived and transported him to Foothills Hospital. And he remained there basically for the remainder of the day. And probably into early evening last night, a battery of tests were taking place, and then TJ was released. He was at home last night with his family, rested. I spoke with TJ. He's feeling good. He's sore. and he, like I said, I'll let Ian kind of go into any more detail, but all of the tests that have been done to date have come back negative. You know, he's doing well. This is going to be, we're not going to leave any stone unturned in terms of the tests that we go through. And no set timetable for TJ's return. You know,
they're going to take care of everything they can. They're going to do everything medically possible to ensure that TJ Brody is as healthy as he possibly can be when he returns to the ice. That's a pretty scary incident. Dr. Ian Ault, who's the team doctor for the Flames, he was involved in helping treat Brody immediately after this happened yesterday. He's been helping administer the tests. He was on the podium this morning as well. And he basically talked about the fact that they still don't know why this happened, but they're starting to rule some things out. And this may be related to a fainting incident. And it sounded like, in hearing from him, let's hear his clip just so you can judge for yourself. But here's Dr. Ian Ault when asked about the possible causes.
I think what we can say is, you know, an event like this can be caused by something inside the brain, something scary, and it can also be caused by what we call syncopal or fainting episodes. And the reasons for why people faint are many, and dehydration certainly could be one of them. I don't think we have all the answers yet. We do have a few more tests to go, but all the early indications are that it's very likely more related to a fainting episode than it is to something significant and inside the brain.
More likely that it's related to that. That's good news for TJ Brody. That's good news for his family. And he went home last night, as you heard Brad Treliving say. He's doing well, was the way he termed it. And it sounds vague, but that's so positive based on what we heard and some people witnessed yesterday at the Saddle Dome. We'll see where this goes. And with something like this, when it comes to fainting, okay, what are the chances of reoccurrence? What are the chances of this doing long-term damage? Nobody knows right now, but don't expect TJ Brody back in the lineup for at least a bit. Oliver Shillington's been recalled. That's how they'll deal with things on the Calgary blue line. They don't have to play until tomorrow. That's good news for his teammates. Obviously, practice yesterday halted immediately, canceled. There were a lot of guys who were shaken up by this, and they now have another day to digest this with the knowledge that their teammate is doing well, that he spent the night with his family. Maybe they all get an opportunity to speak with him at some point today and see him and see that he's doing much better than the last time they saw him leaving the Saddle Dome in an ambulance. But from a psychological standpoint, it's great news that the Flames don't have to play, either last night or today. That's great news. Back-to-backs on the weekend. But now they can perhaps put their minds at ease and get back to their jobs, get back to the task at hand, which is trying to get themselves on a little bit of a roll. The other big incident last night happened in Thursday Night Football. It was Myles Garrett. It was swinging a helmet at Mason Rudolph at the end of the game, connecting with that helmet on Mason Rudolph's head. We do have news this morning as to what has happened, the suspensions. We'll hear from Ian Rappaport on that in a second. But before that, I want you to hear what Baker Mayfield did. And if I am a Cleveland Browns fan, despite the turnovers I've seen this year and despite what has appeared to be regression at times in his passing game, I feel so much better about my quarterback today than I did 24 hours ago. Here's what he had to say after the game.
It's inexcusable. I don't care, rivalry or not, we can't do that. That's kind of the history of, you know, what's been going on here lately, hurting yourself, and that's just endangering the other team. That's inexcusable. He knows that. I hope he does now. It's tough. We'll see.
Mason Rudolph, a friend of yours, Myles Garrett, a teammate of yours. What were you saying to your teammates over there to kind of calm everybody down?
I don't think there's anything in that moment that I can really say to calm him down. You know what? The reality is he's going to get suspended. We don't know how long, and that hurts our team. And we can't do that. We can't continue to hurt this team. That's inexcusable.
We still don't have an idea on the actual final length of the suspension. You'll hear more on that in just one second. But there's some character coming through right there. Really easy to step onto that stage. Aaron Andrews interviewing you on national television and say, hey, look, things got out of control. I didn't really see everything that went down. Obviously, this is bad for everybody. No good for us. No good for them. We don't condone the behavior. But, hey, let's see what he has to say. Maybe some. He could have taken his teammates back there. He could have pleaded the fifth to a certain degree. That's not what Baker Mayfield did. Yeah, I saw it, and it's inexcusable. Even though that's my teammate, even though the code in sports is, no matter what, you got your teammates back. How many times have you seen this in the NHL or any other league where a guy is involved with a dangerous play, a dangerous hit, and there is a teammate, there's a coach that comes out after the game and says, you know what, I didn't see it really. I'll have to get another look at it. We'll await the league's decision, but I didn't really see very much. That happens all the time. All the time. And Baker Mayfield didn't do that. You feel better about your quarterback that he said the right thing, the thing that everyone else was thinking last night when he could have ducked on it. If you're the Browns, you feel way better about Baker Mayfield today. If you're a Browns fan, absolutely you do. Ian Rappaport, he was one who helped break the news this morning of the suspensions. Here's what he had to say.
Well, worth noting that it actually started when Myles Garrett took down Mason Rudolph after he had delivered the ball and slammed him to the turf. That actually is how it got started. But as far as Mason Rudolph himself, from what I understand, fines have not been ruled out for Rudolph, nor have they been ruled out for other players involved in this. It's just that the fines have not yet been determined if they are coming at all. And actually, the players who were suspended, Pouncey, Ogunjobi, obviously Myles Garrett, their fines have not been determined either. There's still a long way to go. This is just really the beginning of figuring out all of this. The NFL just wanted to announce the suspension when they had them. So there still could be players getting fines, significant fines, including Mason Rudolph. But usually those fines don't come for the Thursday night game, at least until a week or so from now.
Ogunjobi gets one game. He's the other defensive lineman that is somewhat involved in this, though does nothing that comes even close to what Myles Garrett did in swinging the helmet and hitting Mason Rudolph. Marquise Pouncey, offensive lineman with the Steelers. He's the guy that went after Garrett after he hit Rudolph in the head. He started throwing punches. He tried to throw a kick when Garrett was on the ground. He gets three games, which comes across as perhaps a little strong, a little bit firm on his suspension, which he may appeal, but they're saying, I don't care. You're not throwing punches in our league. Not happening. You're not kicking a guy when he's on the ground. Here's three games. And then there's Myles Garrett, who's at the top of the list, deservedly so. He gets the rest of the season and postseason, were the Browns to surprise everybody and somehow make it there. And then we'll talk. This is indefinite right now, but it's at least that span, and he has to talk to the commissioner's office for reinstatement. This was a slam dunk for the NFL. This was easy, but good for them for doing the right thing here as well. Gone for the rest of the year. You want to appeal it? Go ahead. But our policy is nothing like this is acceptable in our league. I saw some people somehow, I can't even wrap my head around how some people were trying to defend this last night. Well, look at what Rudolph does when they're on the ground. He kind of has his hand on Garrett's face mask. And what's he doing when he gets up? He doesn't have a helmet on. Why would he even go after a guy? Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? There are rules of engagement. It is an ultra-violent sport in which guys suffer injuries all the time, head injuries all over the place, but there's an accepted circumstance within the game. Okay, here's the risk I'm willing to live with, but you can't go outside of that. And Garrett jumped so far past that line, I have no idea how anyone could even begin to defend his actions last night. Last but certainly not least, I hope we don't have to deal with anything like this in the CFL playoffs this weekend. Grey Cup goes in just over a week's time. It'll be held in Calgary. Will it be the Riders? Will it be the Bombers from the West? Could it be an all-West CFL Grey Cup this year? Eskimos in the Eastern Final against the Hamilton Ticats. Still quarterbacking questions going on right now. People trying to figure out exactly who's going to play and how much. Here's Riders quarterback Cody Fajardo, who also happens to be the West nominee for the most outstanding player this year.
I mean, pretty good. As good as I think it would feel at this point. It's not going to be 100%. That's what I got to know going into this game. I mean, there's going to be a little bit something in there. But at the end of the day, it's adrenaline. And like I said, all week long, it's playoffs. And I got to walk this fine line between getting myself ready for the game and not overworking it, right? Because if you overwork yourself and regress, then you find yourself in a tough situation. So it's this fine line. I think we got a great game plan going into this week and what we're going to do. But everything felt pretty normal and pretty good today. For me, I don't want to be able to squander an opportunity like this. And if it's a little bit painful, so be it. I'm going to be out there with my guys.
That's Fajardo. Yes, he's going to play. Of course he is. It was a back injury that did not allow him to start the season finale. He's had a couple of weeks to get this as good as possible. Riders and Bombers, this is going to be a wild scene. These provinces, these teams, they don't like each other very much. Played three times during the course of the year. Everybody knows they play on Labor Day. They play the Banjo Bowl, the follow-up, the very next week. Riders were 2-1. But interestingly enough, didn't score very many points. Fajardo played in all of those games. Didn't score many points against the Bombers this year. 19, 10, and 21. That's it. They scored a grand total of 50 points in three games, and yet they somehow won two of them. Obviously, the wild card that they haven't seen against them, they've seen him on film for a couple of weeks, Zach Collaros. Only two games that he's played for the Bombers have been against the Calgary Stampeders. We'll see if Chris Streveler plays. He didn't practice this week. How does he factor in the running quarterback that the Bombers can roll out there? Should be a good West final. In the East, Hamilton, heavy favorite, 15-3 this year. Game at home. No Western team, despite winning multiple crossover games, has ever advanced from the East. So the Eskimos, they got to make history if they want to make this an all-West Grey Cup this year. Jason Moss, Trevor Harris and company coming off an outstanding offensive performance in Montreal. But this is a tall order. Ticats have that feel of a team that's just ready to rock, and this feels like their year. Should be fun this weekend. We'll talk a lot more about that on Monday after those games take place, but we'll turn our attention back to the ice next. Hockey Hall of Famer, one of the best defensemen to ever play the game, Scott Niedermayer, joins me here. The CC, a young defenseman in the NHL that reminds him of himself. Find out next on the Scott Rintoul Show.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show.
Here's Niedermayer. He can fly. Niedermayer reshaped the trailer. Niedermayer just missed. Niedermayer scores! Scott Niedermayer, the 21-year-old, showing you why. Despite the fact he's played mostly D for the Devils, he is an offensive threat. Well,
yeah, he certainly was that. He most certainly was that. The Hockey Hall of Famer, four-time Cup champion. Won everything. Scott Niedermayer won everything. Got it all done. He was one of those guys that just had the decorated history all the way down the resume. He got the Cups, the Norris, the Conn Smythe, Olympic gold, you name it, Memorial Cup included. Scott Niedermeyer got it, and he's set to join us here in just 4 minutes' time on the Scott Rentoul Show. I want to know who Scott Niedermeyer credits with his great skating. Was it a certain coach? Is it genetics? Where did that come from? Because that's the first thing I think of when I think of Scott Niedermeyer. Maybe you think of the winning, or maybe there's something else that pops into your mind, but he was such a great skater, and he was a guy who was doing it mostly in the dead puck era. I had the good privilege of watching Scott growing up. I grew up in Kamloops. I've mentioned that a couple of times today. It's just one of those days where there's a lot of connections that way. Kelly Olynyk joined us an hour ago. If you missed that interview, we'll post it for you. I will retweet that for you. You can find me at Scott Rentoul on Twitter, and you can listen to it. Had a lot of great things to say about Canadian basketball, about what it means to him that Canada's hosting this tournament next summer in Victoria, giving this country an opportunity to qualify for the first time since 2000 in men's basketball. A really great opportunity. But Kelly Olynyk, the Kamloops guy, Scott Niedermeyer, played his junior hockey there as well. What a defense pairing that won the Blazers' first Memorial Cup. Was during a run where the Blazers won 3 Memorial Cups in 4 years, and Scott Niedermeyer was a big part of the first team that won. He came back at Christmas. He'd been drafted by the Devils, went to the National Hockey League, and they sent him back. It was a different time, obviously, but they sent him back to Kamloops, felt that was best for his development, came back, was paired with Daryl Sador on the top pairing. Yeah, pretty decent team. Pretty good. And they went on to win the Memorial Cup in Kamloops. As mentioned, that was the start of a lot of winning for Scott Niedermeyer. The 4 Cups, the Olympic gold, the Norris, the Conn Smythe. I'm sure he's heard that a million times as he joins us here on the Scott Rentoul Show. Scott, thank you very much for doing this. How are you this morning?
No, I'm doing well. Thank you. How about you?
I'm doing extremely well, and I wanted to start off with your son. He's playing in the BCHL now. You plied your trade in the WHL. How do you describe yourself as a hockey dad, Scott?
Yeah, it's tougher being a hockey dad than it is being a hockey player, I think sort of sums it up. But it's fun. I enjoy watching my boys, you know, learn the game, make good friends, and enjoy what they're doing. And it brings back memories of when I was their age. So it's fun to see.
You strike me as the calm, cool, collected, and relatively quiet type in the stands.
That's been my personality all along, and it hasn't changed too much as a hockey dad. But I find, you know, watching it as a parent, you definitely view it through a different set of eyes. When you're a player and you're out on the ice, there's a lot of things you don't even think about. Whereas when you're sitting in the stands and watching, you know, some of the hard hits and the different things like that kind of grab you a different way, for sure.
So who initiates the post-game conversations? Does dad start that, or do you wait for your sons?
That's a good question. It's probably me more often than my son saying something. I think I try not to give them too much information or be too demanding of them. I guess I sort of feel I have some things to offer.
I have plenty of questions for you, and I know you have a lot to offer on the way back of that, but do you have any advice for hockey parents out there?
You know, I think, you know, again, thinking back to what it was like, you know, when I was a young player and the reality of the world now of society, things have changed so much. And the thing that I, you know, the best memories I have of playing youth hockey as a young guy are just the friendships and the fun that we had. And I guess my hope would be that the kids playing today can have those same experiences and not be too overwhelmed by, you know, the other things that kind of can get in the way of what you're trying to do on the ice and the enjoyment you get out of the game. So that would be, to me, a priority. Just enjoy the journey, enjoy the process. Things will happen as they're meant to, and don't look too far ahead. Enjoy the moment.
That's great advice for anyone. Scott Niedermeyer, Hockey Hall of Famer, joining us here on the Scott Rentoul Show. Everybody thinks of the skating. At least I do when I think of you and your name comes up. Scott, where did that come from? From your parents? From a particular coach?
You know, obviously, you know, some genetic help for sure. It was a talent that you know, I was blessed with for sure. But along with that, we did get some instruction along the way right from an early age where, you know, we took skating lessons right away and continued to do power skating and different things as we got older. And, you know, the talent combined with the work put in and the teaching from different people definitely helped me. And you're right. I think that was one of the things that allowed me to have success at a high level.
And it stuck out so much in the dead puck era in which you generally plied your trade. After the lockout, it was a little different, but mostly you played during the dead puck era, and you stood out in that regard. Now, we see an NHL that is faster, more wide open, and we see a lot more defensemen that can skate. When you watch the NHL today, Scott, is there a young, mobile NHL D-man that reminds you of the way that you both skated and perhaps played the game?
Yeah, well, yeah, you're exactly right. You don't have to look very far. Not every team has four or five guys that would play similar to the way I did. You know, not the biggest guys, but, you know, good with the puck, move the puck, great skaters, able to defend that way with moving their feet, staying in good position. You know, obviously Quinn Hughes is a pretty talented young guy and fun to watch. You see him out there in open ice, 3-on-3, what he's able to do. So, there's a long list of those guys out there now, which is great.
Is there anyone in the game today that you say, oh, if that guy's on, I got to watch that game?
Yeah, there's a lot of players like that, which is, you know, fun to watch. I mean, some days I get home and turn the TV on and catch a game, and there's always a few guys that you're like, geez, things they can do on the ice are impressive. Obviously, Connor McDavid, McKinnon, you know, Crosby's been doing it for a long time. You watch, you know, the veteran guys they have in Boston and just how smartly and committed they play the game to a team first approach. There's a long list, and it makes the NHL a very exciting league to watch.
For a guy who's one of the best skaters of his generation, what does Connor McDavid's skating say to you? Are you even impressed by that? Is that next level to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I've seen him play live a few times, and it is amazing. I mean, there's times where he looks like he needs to move up a level, you know, to another league, because his speed and agility at that speed is really, I don't know if there's been a player like him. I mean, I played against a few guys, you know, Pavel Bure, for instance, that sort of had probably similar type speed. But I don't know. I would find anyone hard to say that anyone's ever been quicker or more agile than him.
When you were trying to defend Pavel Bure, how did you approach it?
Yeah, I mean, there was no, you know, in a lot of cases I could make up for a mistake by using my skating ability. But with a player like that, there was just no way. If you got caught on the wrong side or caught looking the wrong way, you were in trouble. So it was sort of a constant thing that you had to be aware of. Even when your team had the puck, you had to know where he was, because, like I said, if you got caught out of position, there was no sort of getting back and making up for it.
Scott Niedermeyer, Hockey Hall of Famer, joining me here on the Scott Rintoul Show. Do you ever allow yourself, not that you lacked for any type of success, Scott, but do you ever allow yourself to think, man, I wonder what it would have been like playing with today's game?
You do think a little bit about it, for sure, because it has changed. It's evolved quite a bit. You know, so you do wonder, what would it be like to be out there playing now? There's sometimes, in some games I watch, I'm like, geez, that looks like a whole lot of work. I mean, their feet are moving from the time they step on the ice until the time they get off. And, you know, there's not sort of that, the ability, you know, I played with and against a lot of guys that had the ability to sort of slow the game down and have success in lots of different ways. The way the game is played now, it's pretty much straight ahead, and you have to be able to make real quick plays and quick decisions. You know, so just, yeah, it would be interesting to get out there and sort of see what it's like now.
Watching you play all those years in New Jersey, fans all wondered aloud, man, what kind of numbers would Scott Niedermeyer put up if he was in a more offensive system? Did you ever personally feel shackled by what you guys did with the Devils?
Yeah, I mean, I went through any, you know, growing pains as a professional, as a hockey player, like most guys do at some point in their career. You know, the one thing that I think was, well, I know was sort of the factor in getting me through all that was the success we had as a team. You know, I think pretty much any player would trade any sort of personal accomplishment for winning the Stanley Cup. We were able to win three in New Jersey. So Even though there were moments where, you know, I wished I could do things maybe a little differently. The fact that I was part of those championship teams more than made up for that, or, you know, the disappointment and sort of a style of hockey. And I did go through it, but hard to complain after being part of three champions.
No question about that. Would you have been as good a defenseman as you ended up being if you did not play for Jacques Lemaire?
You know, and that's a great question. And, you know, I look back now, and I think I've said this a number of times, I am sort of very fortunate that I got to play for Jacques and Larry Robinson in New Jersey early in my career. Those were some tough years where I was learning the difficult lessons, but at the same time, I think they taught me a lot about how to have success, ultimate team success as a player, and that did make me a better player as I progressed through my career, for sure.
One of those teammates from the Devils, Brendan Morrison, joins us on this show every single week, and he has commented on a couple of occasions, man, I learned a lot from Lou Lamoriello. I didn't know it at the time, but boy, did I learn a lot from him. What did you learn from Lou?
Yeah, no, and, you know, Lou is a very committed guy. I think maybe that is the number one sort of lesson to be learned from Lou, is just his dedication to the team, to having the team have success, willing to do whatever it takes, the long hours or the amount of work he would put in. And I think that just filters through the organization, where it becomes just an attitude that, you know, what we're here to do is to try to help the team have success. And how can I do that as a player, as a coach, as a manager, trainers, whoever is involved? And, you know, sort of that, creating that atmosphere in the organization, I think is the way you have success. And that was Lou's focus, for sure.
Norris winner, Conn Smythe winner, multiple cup winner, Scott Niedermayer joining me here on the Scott Rintoul Show. Who's the best defenseman you ever played against or ever saw?
You know, I remember as a young guy getting into the league, and, you know, guys I grew up watching like Ray Bourque and Paul Coffey, you know, two in my mind, great, great defensemen that I tried to sort of emulate when I was a young guy, you know, and then more of a contemporary that was always amazing, and how effective he was Lidstrom. Just how smart he was and how much he accomplished without drawing a lot of attention to his game, his ability to make good decisions and always be in the right place, you know, was amazing to me. So those would be guys that I would mention, I guess.
Was there anything in particular that Lidstrom did that you said, man, I wish I was better at that? I'm going to try to get better at that because Nick Lidstrom just has this, and I wish I could add that to my game.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the things that he did so well was his ability to get his shots to the net in an effective way. You know, like you had mentioned how the game has sort of changed over the years. So many players, almost every player now is committed to trying to block shots. So as a defenseman, it's extremely difficult just to get a shot on net when you're out at the blue line. And he was very effective at that, just with a little misdirection or being able to do it with his head up and get the puck to the net. And, you know, that's a simple way, but a very effective way to create offense. And, you know, I think that was his big talent that seems easy. You know, when you just mention it, it's like, oh, geez, how hard can that be? But it's a tricky thing to do, and he was, if not the best at it, one of them.
As you mentioned earlier, you got three cups in New Jersey. You get your last one with your brother in Anaheim. And then after that, you contemplated retirement in 2007. You missed almost the first half of the season before you came back. There's a couple guys right now, Justin Williams and Dustin Byfuglien. They're going through a similar process, one of them aided and abetted by an injury in Byfuglien's case. What advice would you give to those guys, Scott, about coming back if either decides that they want to make that commitment again?
You know, I don't know if there's any great advice I would have for them, other than I would say, having gone through that type of decision, a big decision like that, it's extremely difficult, extremely personal. You know, it's obviously a decision where, you know, I guess you can go play pickup hockey, you can go get on the ice, but you can't really sort of emulate or find that anywhere else other than playing in the NHL. And then playing in the NHL is obviously a massive commitment. So there's really no middle ground in your opportunities as a hockey player, as a professional hockey player. So it's a extremely difficult decision. And, you know, I, like you said, I went through it once and tried to find an answer. I came back to play for a number of years after that, and really gave me a new perspective on everything, just to realize that this wasn't going to go on forever and enjoy every second of it. And I guess that would ultimately be my advice, is recognizing the reality of that decision.
What was it that you missed the most? Was it the competition? Was it the camaraderie? What was it?
I think first, it definitely was your teammates. You know, the fun you have together. You're together a lot, and you definitely have a unique, special bond as teammates, with the work you put in on the ice, trying to have success, and the time you spend together. So that, I think, is number one. And yeah, number two, like you said, would be the big moments, playoff hockey, big games during the regular season, where, you know, kind of got those competitive juices flowing. Those for sure would be the two things that stand out.
Going way back to those Kamloops days, you won everything, starting with Memorial Cup. Anytime a team wins a championship, there's this connectivity that goes through the years and is timeless. But you won so much. I'm wondering, which of those numerous championship teams that you were with are you closest with now?
That's a good question. I think, like you said, there always is a special bond there. And actually in New Jersey, you know, coming up in February, I believe, we're going back for a 20-year reunion on one of our championship teams. We've done that in the past. Actually going up to Kamloops for another sort of reunion amongst some of the players there that were part of successful teams. So I guess it's just the shared memories of that challenge and sort of being able to have success and achieve that championship together, that never really goes away. And you can kind of pick up and talk about those things forever. And it is special. And I think what it is you sort of realize that, especially in hockey, that none of that would have happened without all those other guys involved. So, you know, you appreciate, you read out the successes and the titles and different things I've been a part of, but there's a massive number of people that made all that happen, and I was a small piece of it.
I still remember you springing Zach Boyer. Never forget that. That one that won the Blazers, the Memorial Cup. I mean, that's imprinted on my mind. I imagine you've got so many moments like that over the years.
No, and absolutely. There are a lot of moments, some big ones like that get a lot of attention. There's a lot of little moments, you know, of little plays that either you made or your teammate made that you realize were a big reason why you were able to win a game or have success over the stretch of a playoff run. So, yeah, I mean, that's what makes it special, absolutely.
Well, Corey Hirsch, one of your old teammates, works with us here at Sportsnet, and he smiles every time you bring up Kamloops and the Kamloops Blazers. I know you're the same way. Have fun when you go back for that reunion in February. I know that's going to be a big weekend.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Scott. That's Scott Niedermeyer, very gracious with his time this morning, and so many different things to hit with him. Quinn Hughes is the guy he picked out right now that he really enjoys watching on the back end. But as he said, every single team seems to have one or more of those guys. Not necessarily exactly what Quinn Hughes does, but not the biggest defenseman, a more mobile defenseman, a guy who can offensively push the pace. And it's just such an entertaining game to watch right now. Man, was he good. He was so good during the course of his career. And as I said, just won everything. Chris Pronger tells a story about that 2002 team that won in Salt Lake. And there was a game where they had to kill off a lengthy 5-on-3, either 2 minutes in duration or close to it. We all know how good Chris Pronger was and just what a physical specimen he was. But the puck got hemmed in the zone, and they were out there seemingly forever in that span before they finally cleared the puck. But they were under duress, so much pressure. Pronger and Niedermeyer, the two defensemen on the penalty kill at the time. And they finally get the puck out, and they're able to change up their penalty killers. And they get to the bench, and Pronger's looking for oxygen because they've been working so hard. They've been out there for so long. The moment is so big because you're in the Olympics. And he is just panting and doing everything he can to try to get oxygen back in his system. And he looks over, and Niedermeyer's just sitting there, just breathing normally. Doesn't look like he's been doing anything. Looks like he's barely sweating because he was such a good skater and he was so efficient with his movement that he didn't have to work as hard as other guys in those moments, and he could just effortlessly glide to places. But you're talking about one Hall of Famer recognizing a trait in another Hall of Famer that he certainly didn't have. And you heard that, I think, with Scott Niedermayer there talking about Nick Lidstrom. It sounds like such a simple thing as well. It really does. Canucks game last night, for example, there's a couple of plays where they turn the puck over in the offensive zone and because of a blocked shot. And Scott Niedermayer said, I know it sounds simple, just find a way to get the shot through. Nick Lidstrom did it so effectively and so effortlessly that Scott Niedermayer took note of that and said, well, there's something I can improve in my game. I wonder if I can get better moving the puck through the way Nick Lidstrom does. But these are the kind of contemporaries we're talking about. Excellent interview with Scott Niedermayer. If you missed that in its entirety, we'll have that posted for you soon. We'll tweet that out. You can get to our website, sportsnet.ca, and you can download it there. The Kelly Olynyk interview will be available for your consumption there as well. Excellent stuff with Scott Niedermayer today, who, as I mentioned, won everything. His son's now playing in the BCHL up in Penticton. So he gets out, watches as many games as he can. And he'll be back as part of that Canlis Blazer reunion that they're going to have in mid-February, celebrating some of the great teams, great players that that franchise has had. Pretty impressed with Connor McDavid, though, isn't he? Like the rest of us. He saw what happened last night. Man, McDavid was everywhere. And shut her down, basically, after 40 minutes. Didn't need any more after the 6 points. Up to 37 on the season. Dreisaitl's got 21. He had 5 assists in that game last night. Oilers continue to lead the Pacific Division with 28 points. Busy weekend coming up, one that is filled with CFL playoffs on Sunday as we determine the combatants for next week's Grey Cup in Calgary, Hamilton and Edmonton in the East. Then you've got that followed by the first time since 1972 that the Bombers and Riders will meet in the West Final. That's going to be bedlam in Regina over the course of the weekend. You got a full slate of NHL, a lot of hockey coming up, so we are going to be jam-packed on Monday as well. Excellent show today. This is where we leave you, Calgary, for the week. We're going to send you to Hockey Central. Plenty to talk about in the wake of what happened with TJ Brody yesterday. You'll hear extended audio from Brad Treliving, Dr. Ian Auld. They addressed everyone today to update TJ Brody's condition. Here in Vancouver, we got a game to dig into from last night, and John Scott, All-Star Game MVP. He's in town, and I will speak to him next right here on the Scott Rentoul Show.
This is the Scott Rentoul Show.
Besser shoots and scores right off the draw.
First career NHL goal, Quinn Hughes.
On the official home of the Canucks.
And it's Markstrom again, this time with the glove.
He has covered an 8 shoots, scores!
Sportsnet 650.
Janssen with a chance. John Scott scores! John Scott following. He puts it in, and all of a sudden, it's 4-3. Big John gets his first goal. Wow! Broken nose and all. He finds the back of the net.
Broke a few along the way, too. John Scott, former NHL enforcer, former NHL All-Star Game MVP. He is in Vancouver. And he is going to join me in just a few minutes' time. This is Scott Rentoul and the Scott Rentoul Show. I got to tell you about Adam Forsyth's trip at some point during the course of this hour. It might be the worst thing I've ever heard. Just the worst trip ever. He's planning this sports trip down to L.A., and it is going to hell in a handbasket. Kind of the way things did at times for the Vancouver Canucks last night. I know there was some consternation about the head coach and why is JT Miller not playing with Pettersson and Besser, and that should have happened more often, despite the fact Miller was everywhere last night. Played with every line. Had him out there at some point with everybody. I'm not sure putting JT Miller with Pettersson and Besser was going to stop odd man rushes for the Dallas Stars. Well, they would have possessed the puck more on the offensive end, and they would have scored more. Maybe they would have. But I don't see the alignment of the forward lines is the bigger issue for the Vancouver Canucks last night. And here's a question I would pose to the market right now, and you can hit me up at the Subway text line, 650-650 throughout the course of the hour. Are you at a point with the Canucks yet where you're comfortable enough with what they are that one loss doesn't rattle you? Or are you doing some hand-wringing? Ah, we can't lose a game like that. Man, they just can't get rolling here. They'd lost 4 in a row, and then they finally snapped that, only to lose to Dallas on the other side. Just not sure. Where are you at? Are you still hand-wringing? They're 20 games in. They're in the thick of the Pacific Division right now. Where are you at with the hand-wringing? I didn't see the coach's decision with the forward lines as the big transgression last night. Anytime you lose, you can pick it apart. No question about it, and you are entitled to your opinion every time out. Maybe you didn't like the way they were rolling out the lines before the game. I actually liked it. I liked the fact that they said, okay, Adam Gaudette, you're a guy who has 6 points in 9 games so far. You haven't even gone 2 games in a row without a point. So if you're going to be one of our three centermen, what's the best way for you and by virtue of that, us to succeed? We think it's by giving you skilled wingers. So we're going to do that. Instead of plugging you into a third line role and trying to get you to play something similar to what Brandon Sutter was doing, we're going to give you offensive guys. And we'll actually take a little bit of offense as far as skill goes away from the Bo Horvat line because we know we're going to have to lean on that one a little more defensively. And I do think this was missed yesterday. Bick and I talked about it at some point during Canucks Central. By the way, Alex Aull joins us on Canucks Central. He'll have his play of the week. He'll break that down for you, and we'll get his opinion on what he's seen over the course of these 3 games in Vancouver this week. But Bick and I talked about the fact that, listen, it's not just Sutter's out. All of the defensive responsibility winds up with Horvat because Beagle's out too. That's how it has to go. No, he didn't say that. We didn't say that, I should say. Elias Pettersson's line gets a little bit of that as well. They're not afraid to play him against good lines. They're not afraid to hide him or to put him up against dangerous players from the other side because they think he's good enough that not only is he responsible defensively, but they can handle themselves at any area of the ice and they can play a little keep away at times too. I don't think the lineup was the big transgression, but you're free to disagree. You can hit me up 650-650. I see it more as they got destroyed in transition last night. Dallas, pretty patient team, allowed the Canucks to be aggressive at times and then capitalized on that aggressiveness. Speaking of aggressive, he was most certainly that during the course of his NHL career. That is now over, but he's keeping himself busy with a lot of things, and he's in Vancouver today. The Spartan Foundation, in support of Spartan Athletics, has brought in John Scott, a presentation of Nicola Wealth, to speak at an event this evening. John, thank you very much for doing this. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
No problem whatsoever. As mentioned, you're at a speaking engagement that tonight. I know you're not going to roll out your whole speech for me, but what is the message you're going to try to get across to this group this evening?
Just, it's funny. I kind of curtail my talks based on my audience. But, you know, just talk about leadership, commitment to excellence, just what I've learned throughout my career, kind of persevering through adversity. Just kind of touch on all those little topics.
Before we get to your career, what's keeping you busy these days?
5 little girls. I got 5 little girls back home. So, day. Honestly, I just kind of retired hockey to spend more time with the family. So that's it.
Buddy, I've got 2 little girls of my own. I don't know how you get it done with 5. How does that happen? That is harder than any shift you ever had, isn't it?
My wife is a saint. It's tough, but it's fun. Yeah, my oldest is 7. Then we have 5, 3, 3, and 2. So it's just controlled chaos at all times. But it keeps me young, so I say.
Controlled chaos. We could have described you of that at times during your NHL career. John Scott joining me here. And I think this is a good segue with the children because it was the children that actually cemented your decision to take the step toward what is arguably the most prominent moment of your career, the NHL All-Star Game, becoming the MVP. How did your kids play into that decision?
Yeah, it was one of those things where, I think a lot of people know I had a conversation with the league, and they came after my duties as a father, and they asked how my children would feel if I would go to the All-Star Game. And that really kind of resonated, upset me a little bit, ticked me off, and my kids, you know, I think they would be proud of me if I went, and I just figured what better event for them to see Dad kind of bow out of the league would be the All-Star event. So they played a big role in that.
Is that the coldest business moment you had during your time in the league?
Yeah, it's funny. The NHL is all business, and you realize that after your first few years, but that was definitely the peak of it. But yeah, every year GMs, they They lie to you. They go behind your back. It's just norm, you know. It's a business.
You weren't a guy who was destined for the National Hockey League. Take me through your journey to the NHL, one that you never thought was certainly a fait accompli.
Yeah, it's funny. I just never expected it. I luckily got a scholarship to Michigan Tech University. Thought I would get a degree and then go and work back home. But somehow, I guess it helps being 6'8". That opens up a lot of eyes and people see potential there. So that kind of opened the door, and I worked my tail off in the AHL and somehow made it in and just kind of transitioned from a defenseman to a fighter, a fourth line guy, and just did whatever I could to stay into the league for 9 years.
Yeah, 6'8 helps. I'm 5'7". That didn't help as much. I'll be honest with you, John. They didn't see as
no,
much potential.
No.
Yeah, very surprising, isn't it? John Scott joining me here on the Scott Rintoul Show. You mentioned it. People assume that you would have had to have been a pugilist growing up. You weren't a fighter. How did you become one?
It was just out of necessity, really. I went to the AHL, and I was just getting challenged left and right. And I'm not one to back down, so I just felt like, hey, like let's see how this goes. And I just started winning fights, and it just became like another tool in my toolbox that I could use. And yeah, I played college for 4 years. I got in one fight in college with cages on. So it's not something where I was, you know, playing in the dub, fighting three times a night for 4 years. It just kind of happened organically.
Did it ever worry you? Were you scared about it?
Oh gosh, yeah. Are you kidding me? You're 5'7", so what would it be like to go to sleep at night thinking you're going to fight a guy who's 6 foot? You know, it was the same thing for me. I was fighting these monsters who were 6'5", 250, and were just like trained assassins. And I was just completely naive and kind of overmatched sometimes skill-wise. I wasn't a big fighter. I didn't have much history. So it was a constant just mental battle where I was like, holy moly, I'm going to get beat up every game I play in.
I think people would be surprised to hear that. And I think that most fighters have that at some point of their career. It's a tight fraternity. Did you find that with other enforcers as well, that they constantly worried about it and didn't necessarily love the job?
Yeah, you would never talk about it during your career because you don't want to show any kind of weakness. So after I was done playing, it's funny talking to like Marty McSorley and George LaRocque and other fighters, Colt Norris around the league, and they're like, yeah, man, it was just such a battle every single night. I was so scared. And it just kind of confirmed, like, okay, I wasn't the only one. Everybody has these issues. Because no one, unless you're like a complete lunatic, likes to fist fight. It's just not natural. It's not a natural instinct to like fighting and getting punched in the face unless you got a couple screws loose up there.
Especially when you've got to convince family and friends that it's a good idea. How did those discussions in the early days of accepting that challenge go with your wife?
Yeah, she didn't get it because she grew up in the States and she didn't really watch hockey growing up. So to her, it was just like, what, you fight? Why do you do this? And I just had to explain to her it's part of the game. And she was always confident in my skills. Like I'm 6'8". When I played, I was like 270. So I was the biggest guy out there, and she wasn't nervous about me getting hurt. She was honestly nervous about me hurting people. So she would constantly tell me like, hey, take it easy. Don't hurt somebody. Like, win the fight, but let's just not go overboard with it here.
And that sounds counterintuitive, but did you ever worry about that as well, that you might actually hurt somebody too badly during the course of a fight?
Yeah, I played juniors for a year, and I fought some kid who was smaller, and he was just a scrapper, and I almost like exploded his eyeball to the point where he was blind, and that really stuck with me throughout my career, where it's like, okay, win the fight, but don't injure somebody. And you can see in my fights, if I have someone in bad position, I don't really, you know, continue hitting them. I just let up, and you know, I won the fight. There's no need to hurt somebody.
Former NHLer, former NHL All-Star Game MVP John Scott joining me here on the Scott Rintoul Show. You went to college, as you mentioned. You've got a mechanical engineering degree. You're a bright guy. Did the stereotype that's associated with fighters, I should say, ever bother you?
Not really. People, they have these perceptions, and they can, you know, say whatever they want. I knew, you know, I wasn't what people wrote about me in the media or said on these radio shows or whatever. Because when people get to know me, it's funny to see the reaction when someone actually meets me and talks to me. They're like, wait a minute, you're not like this caveman. You're actually a nice guy who has kids and is kind of funny sometimes. It's almost this kind of satisfying moment. I'm like, yeah, actually, I am kind of a nice guy. So it didn't bother me, but it bothered my wife and family a lot when they would read these articles, and they would just irk them because they knew me and nobody else did.
Have you ever had to explain to your kids what you did for a living and why you did it?
They still have no idea. They've seen some videos where relatives have shown them, and I've like freaked out on my relatives a little bit, like, don't show them that. I just say I wrestled, you know, some guy was bad and I wrestled him to the ice. My oldest is 7, so I don't think I need to have that conversation. When they get older, we'll talk about it. And I'll just say, yeah, I fought. Like, it was just something that I had to do, and I got paid well to do it. So it was just, you know, part of the job.
And it'll be do as I say, not as I did, correct?
I hope so.
Yeah, I imagine.
Although one of them is a fighter, so we'll see.
Not literally, but she's just got a little bit of, you know, adrenaline in her, is what you're telling me.
No, she will literally punch her sisters if things don't go her way.
Okay.
The short fuse.
Yeah, you're going to want to nip that in the bud. John Scott with me on the Scott Rintoul Show. So you're a really bright guy, and you had another career path had you chosen to take it. How did you rationalize it, John, doing what you did for a living and knowing that your brain could take you another direction?
Yeah, Well, it's a lot of money. Like, don't get me wrong, the money was great, and it was a childhood dream. I was born in Edmonton, Alberta, grew up in a trailer park. My parents didn't have 2 pennies to rub together when we were growing up, so it was this lifelong dream to play in the NHL, and I really appreciated it. I loved the private jets, the first-class restaurants, like all this stuff, and I just figured I would ride it out as long as I could, and I knew the risks going in. Like, I knew all about the concussions and injuries. I was well aware of that, so I kind of just went for it. Like, who would turn down the NHL, honestly, a Canadian kid?
No, and you're right. Very few would. Do you worry about it at all today with concussions and some of the studies that have come out?
Yeah, everybody, like, obviously, there's so many terrible stories out there. And I have had conversations with my wife and my family and stuff. And it's something that we talk about and I'm worried about. I haven't had too many concussions, thankfully, but you know, I do get mood swings where I just kind of want to close myself off and just be by myself for a little bit. And that sometimes that's for an hour, sometimes that's for a couple days. And I don't know if that's just me or, you know, getting hits to the head, but I'm thankfully not as bad as other guys out there who seem like the concussions really did a number on them.
So when those episodes happen, how do you deal with it?
I just lean on my family, you know, and I'm lucky to have that kind of network where my wife can just say, hey, like, you're starting to change. Like, let's just turn it around. And then usually that works. So that's a huge factor.
You've written a book. There's a movie being made about you. There's a podcast about you. Obviously, you were the NHL All-Star Game MVP. You had a career. What are you most proud of?
I'm proud, honestly, just sticking around. I think in my day, Gary was really working to get rid of the fighters. And I was one of the last guys who kind of stuck around, transitioned my game. I wasn't really a one-trick pony. I could actually play, which I think people were surprised to see. So I'm proud of that, and I'm just proud I didn't really, you know, cave into the NHL when they tried to get me to back out of the NHL All-Star Game and stuff like that. I just kind of stood my ground and stayed true to myself.
What was the most surprising part of that experience for you?
The amount of support I got from everybody. It was, it's so funny. It started off as such a negative thing, and people were just coming at me left and right with just, you don't belong, you're not a good hockey player, you're going to embarrass yourself. And then that just kind of transitioned into such a positive thing where players and former players and people all over the country were just reaching out saying, well, you know, we believe in you, we got your back, you should do this, it's going to be great. And just the amount of support I received was overwhelming.
Was there a player or former player in particular that showed you that support that really resonated with you, John?
It was a lot of the former fighters, honestly. The Chris Nylands, the Tony Twists, the Marty McSorleys, the Stu Grimsons, a lot of these guys who I looked up to as a kid, they reached out to me, whether it was in person or phone calls or via text. And that really went a long way in my decision to go to the game, because I was on the fence whether this was the right thing to do or not, whether I should go or stay home. And just to have those guys, you know, who did my job to say, hey, this is good for the, you know, our brand. Go out there and show people, like, we can play and we can hang with these guys, and we're not just these one-trick ponies who just get punched in the face for a living.
And Chris Nylund was a guy who went to an All-Star game as well, was he not?
Yeah, Knucks went back in the day because he put up good points. People forget that. They just think he's just this crazy guy. And Marty McSorley should have went to an All-Star game. He was a very talented player, but people just, when they think back, they think of all the stick thing with Brashear here in Vancouver, and, you know, he's a lunatic.
Yeah, they do. You're right. That's the first thing they remember, but they do forget that he was a very good player back in his day. Was there a skill player, and I use that term loosely, at that NHL All-Star game, a high-end guy who came up to you and said, hey, man, we're really glad you're here. I'm glad you did this.
Yeah, it's funny. Taylor Hall, I was totally blown away. We were just kind of hanging out after the game, and he just came up to me unprompted and just really just had a nice conversation. He said, this is great. You know, it's usually the same thing when we come to these All-Star games. There's nothing really exciting, and it was just really great that you came. And I was really happy to be on your team because he was playing for Edmonton at the time, I believe. And he really went out of his way to say that. And he was just such a young kid at the time. So that really kind of stuck out. We're like, hey, you know, that was really nice of him. He didn't have to do that.
Well, what just stuck out with you relaying that story to me is what a life to lead where you're like, yeah, every time we come to these All-Star games, it's pretty much the same thing. It would be nice
right?
to be knowing every year you're going to be there.
What a luxury. I know.
What was the closest team you ever played for during your career?
It's funny. It was one of my last teams, San Jose, just because I think a lot of the guys there, when I was there, we were in the same stage in life. We were a little older. We had families, and we really kind of bonded. I still talk with Jumbo and Pavs and Cooch and Bernsey and a lot of those guys, and I just feel like we kind of were all in the same point in our life. I talked to Patty Marleau. It's just, it's funny. I was only there for a year, but that team, I still talk to a lot of those guys.
Before I let you go, where's the movie at in terms of its development?
It's in the works. I've been saying this. I don't know. I say, let me know when I need to be on set because I want to be in the movie and I'll be there. But I'm pretty sure they're close to signing the actor to play me. That's been the biggest sticking point. They've gone from like this guy to that guy to the other guy, but they have a pretty big guy lined up right now. And I'm hoping he's going to sign on in the next month, I guess. And then they have everything else kind of lined up, the money, the location. So who knows? It's Hollywood, baby. I don't know.
I love it. You're already in the life. It's Hollywood, baby. Do you get any say on who plays you?
None at all. I'm not in the life. I am in changing poopy diapers life. Trust me. Don't get it twisted here.
No, I know all about it. I'm just saying, if you had a say on who plays you, I think you would do what we all would do. Hey, the guy who plays me, I'm going to upgrade myself. I'm going to make sure that that's a guy who is a lot better looking and maybe in better shape than I am. That's what I would do.
That's not hard to do in my case. So it's a pretty wide field where they can pick. I just want someone who's over 6'3". That's what I wanted, rather than not, you know, get someone who's 5'10 and try to make it work. I want someone tall.
I would do the same thing. And for obvious reasons, as we discussed earlier.
You're out.
Yeah, I'm out. You already cut me. You're a heightist. So I'm out of this discussion. Hey, John, great talking with you. I know everybody's going to enjoy you speaking tonight here in Vancouver. Congratulations on everything that's going on with your family and that you have a weekend away so you can take a break from poopy diapers. Have fun at this event tonight.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That's John Scott, former NHLer, former NHL All-Star Game MVP. He is speaking tonight at a Spartan Foundation event that's in support of Spartan Athletics, which take place at Trinity Western University. He's a presentation of Nikola Wealth. And our thanks to the fine folks at the Spartan Foundation who put us in touch with John Scott. He's such an interesting story and a compelling character. And you think of the different avenues he could have gone. This isn't a guy who was destined for the league. He just got really big. And everybody coveted the size. And while he wasn't even a guy who was going to go on to play beyond what he was doing as a teenager and then had a good enough season to get himself a scholarship to Michigan Tech and got there. But as he says, when he writes his book and when he talks about all of his stories leading up to it, man, I just wanted to go there, get a good education. I was pretty content with, okay, you're going to wind up with a good degree and a job where you can put your feet up in an office, and that was going to be just fine back in Ontario. And then everything went the way it did. He winds up in the NHL, obviously because of the size, decides, I guess I'll have to be a fighter if I'm going to stick around, and people find a place for him in the game, and then ends up going on to the NHL All-Star Game MVP. It's a really compelling story. As mentioned, he's written a book. There's a movie in the works. And one of those players that I will most certainly admit I had preconceived notions about, You know what the role is in the game. It's not the role that I find the most entertaining in the National Hockey League. I'm more about the high-end skill guys. That's the style of hockey I appreciate more than the guys who go out there and fight. Hey, I grew up like the rest of you enjoying that part of the game, but as I've gotten older, I enjoy that part of the game less. So I had preconceived notions about John Scott, his role, what he must be about, and then you start to hear him speak. You start to hear his personality. You start to hear there's a very bright guy and a well-thought-out guy on the other side of it, and it changes the way you think about people. Fighters have always been beloved in this sport, always. Embraced by every market they're in, and they have always formed this great relationship with the fan base and with hockey fans at large. But there is a preconceived stereotype that goes with it, and this is one of the guys who certainly helps break that down. I'm sure he'll have a great speech tonight and get a lot of people in on the conversation. We want you in on our conversation. We'll start to dig into what happened to the Vancouver Canucks last night. Big off-field transgressions going on, or on-field, I should say, transgression with Miles Garrett, and we'll get into that a little bit on the other side, what you saw last night in Cleveland, and Kelly Olynyk. Massive news for Canada men's basketball today. We had Kelly Olynyk on the show today. You'll hear his reaction to the big news that's coming here. It's coming to BC. This feels like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and I can't wait for it. We'll talk about it next right here on the home of the Vancouver Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show on the official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Now it comes to Levo on the right boards. He's forced wide by Heiskanen. Goes behind the net. Passes left corner for Pettersson. To the point for Jordy Benn. Across to the right side. Troy steps over the shot. He scores! Troy from Richmond finds the back of the net. His second of the season with traffic in front. And the Canucks tie the game in two.
Had their chances last night. They had their chances. They weren't awful in this loss to the Dallas Stars. This is not a sky is falling type conversation. And I do wonder where people are at with the Canucks here 20 games in. I'm sure there are some things you are convicted on. And maybe there's some concerns you still have. And you probably still have some questions that remain unanswered. I think that would be natural. I do wonder if you're at a point, though, that you've seen enough consistency with the way they play this season that has you saying, hey, it's just a loss. That's okay. Those are going to happen. I can live with it. I'm not five alarm. What do we do? Where do we go? Uh-oh, this is all going to come apart. Or are you on the other side of that where, hey, man, 20 games in, but the trend lately, as far as wins and losses go, little worried right now. Is this going to be another one of those Novembers? Where are you at as a Canucks fan? Do you have a different feeling as far as your confidence in what this team does, how it rights the ships, all of those things? Hit me up, Subway text message inbox, 650-650. This one comes in. Two of the best defensive forwards are out, guys that are putting major pressure on other teams' top lines in all three zones. Both Sutter and Beagle were forcing turnovers and putting the opponents on their heels during the great start to this season. Those guys being hurt forces the rest of the room to play less aggressively, less to their strengths, as they play more defensive-minded. Having said that, this should be temporary. We shouldn't panic. The Canucks will survive this slump and get back to winning in short order. Adversity leads to success. That's from Ben in 100 Mile House. Great stuff. Great stuff from Ben. He's not panicking right now. This team is not forlorn if they don't get Beagle and Sutter back in a hurry. But it does change the personality of the team and certainly of that forward group with the guys they have in there right now. And it changes the trust factor more than anything else with the head coach. He's not going to put Adam Gaudette out there in matchup situations. Now, I don't think he hid him last night whatsoever. Travis Green gave him enough ice, let him get out there, try to do his thing, and there were moments, especially in the offensive zone, where Gaudette was good last night. It's not the best game we've seen him play, but he wasn't awful. And there were times, there was specifically in the first period, one that comes to mind, a puck that he's got in his own corner that he was just a little soft on trying to get it out of the zone. And it leads to offensive zone pressure for the Dallas Stars, and eventually it leads to a penalty for Troy Stetcher. Yeah, Travis Green won't like that, but I didn't see a guy who looked at Adam Gaudette last night and said, we got to hide him a little bit here. Had him up to 14.5 minutes of ice. Gaudette was averaging around 11 and a half minutes. So that's a significant increase. And we'll see where it goes from here. But I don't get the sense that he's going to try to hide Gaudette. Will he shelter him at times? Yes, because there are still deficiencies in his defensive game. There are times when he's physically not going to be able to handle a couple of the guys he's going to be matched up with. And that's why you see putting a guy like JT Miller there. Ride shotgun. And I know he moved all over the place in the lineup last night, and that speaks to his versatility more than anything else. I know there were some that were somewhat upset as to where Miller played in the lineup last night. I get it. In my ideal world, JT Miller is on the top line. But I also don't think it's this major transgression if he's not there right now. It made a lot of sense the way they went out last night. I will listen to that and I will watch that. And I do think it's smart for them to try to not only balance the scoring out through those three lines, but also insulate Adam Gaudette a little bit here. That, yes, we are going to give you an opportunity. And yes, we are going to give you more minutes and you're back to your natural position. But we're also going to give you some quality wingers to play with here. And we're going to give you one guy in particular who will help the defensive side of your game. That line wasn't great last night, but it wasn't bad. They did create a couple of opportunities through the first 40 minutes specifically. 4-2 loss against one of the hottest teams in the NHL and a team that burned them in transition. That, to me, was the biggest takeaway from last night's game, not which lines were playing together. And for the first time this season, we did see Travis Green mix up the defensive pairings. Didn't get into it very much following the game, but he mixed them up. He was looking for some kind of spark with his team. They get through that second period at 2-2. Maybe we're talking about a different result last night, but they allowed that third goal and they just couldn't find that next one. A night when their power play wasn't particularly good. Dallas's penalty kill looked strong. Dallas looked very aggressive on the penalty kill in zone. And the Canucks didn't seem to have that urgency that they've had on the power play at other times during the course of this season. But it's not a horrific loss. It shouldn't be looked at like that. Not whatsoever, in my opinion. This is the Scott Rintoul Show. You're welcome to get in anytime. You've got the text message inbox, 650-650. That is brought to you by Subway. Regarding last night's game, when a defensive team goes Jacques Lemaire on you, Travis Green should have made some in-game adjustments to counter. Travis always talks about the learning process to become a championship-caliber team. Well, coach, you were schooled last night. I hope you learned from last game and perhaps a game plan for next time. A bit harsh or fair? I would say a bit harsh. Sign your text. Love to get you in on the conversation, but I want to give you credit for getting your text on air. I think that's a bit harsh. I think the coach shares in the blame for last night, but some of it's on the execution as well. Travis Green, I'm fairly certain, has told the guys don't turn the puck over. And that's more on the execution. You got to let these guys play as well. I can tell you this. They got schooled when they did turn the puck over. Dallas looked like a very patient team, content to try to keep the Canucks to the outside when they were having any offensive zone time. But the second they saw an opportunity for transition game, they turned it on. And they just were far better in that respect last night. The Stars took massive advantage of that. Started with the opening goal. Tyler Myers gets caught out of position because he thinks that puck's going to get rimmed all the way around the boards. And then he's way too far over on the right side of the ice, out of position. Next thing you know, Stars up ice, puck in the back of the net. That's it. Thank you very much. And that was kind of a theme the rest of the way. Not that every rush was generated like that, but that's how the Stars got all of their goals yesterday. Canucks got crushed. Odd man rushes the other way. Dallas was able to generate a lot of them, and they were able to capitalize in transition. That, by the way, is the best goal I've seen Blake Como score since the 2006 World Juniors. Maybe that's not fair, but I haven't seen him score a lot of skill goals like that. He was part of a top line here in 2006 that helped Canada win a gold medal at home. And it was at the same arena. It was pretty fun to watch. But that's not what we know Blake Como for. We know him for being a pretty responsible guy defensively, matchup guy, third or fourth line guy. That was a nice goal he scored last night, though I'm sure Jacob Markstrom would counter and say, I would like that one back. Nice goal, though. I think he caught. I don't think Markstrom thought the shot was coming as quick as it did last night from Blake Como. Not concerned, this is from West End, LA. Our defense from the goalie on out is as strong as it's ever been in some time. We will be in the mix right to the end for a playoff berth. All right. That's from West End LA. Continue to send it in. I will get to what happened on the field in Cleveland in just a couple of minutes' time, but I wanted to play this for those of you who may not have caught the update this morning. TJ Brody collapsed on the ice during practice. You can only imagine how concerning that was for his teammates yesterday and how shaken and rattled they were. Media who were in attendance, they were a little discombobulated. They called it one of the most difficult days they've ever had, witnessing what they did, seeing Brody collapse, convulsions on the ice, out of there in an ambulance. Brad for Living at the podium today in Calgary updated TJ Brody's condition.
After a few minutes, you know, TJ was alert. He was responsive on the ice. The EMS team ambulance arrived and transported him to Foothills Hospital. And he remained there basically for the remainder of the day. And probably into early evening last night, a battery of tests were taking place, and then TJ was released. He was at home last night with his family, rested. I spoke with TJ. He's feeling good. He's sore. and he, like I said, I'll let Ian kind of go into any more detail, but the... all of the tests that have been done to date have come back negative. You know, he's doing well. This is going to be, we're not going to leave any stone unturned in terms of the tests that we go through. And no set timetable for TJ's return. You know,
no set timetable. Flames, they've got back-to-back games this weekend. But as I said earlier in the show, you can only imagine how difficult it would have been for Calgary to play last night if they were forced into action, if they happen to have a game on the schedule, if that had occurred at a morning skate. Thank goodness the schedule has a couple of days here for everybody to breathe in Calgary and for TJ Brody and his family specifically to do that. And now his teammates can at least have their minds put somewhat at ease, because that is a traumatic scene to witness, what they did yesterday. And the confusion and... you know, just being frightened in that moment, that's tough to shake. That's very difficult to shake. That was one of two scary incidents, as I mentioned, that happened yesterday. The other was certainly within someone's control, and that's Miles Garrett. He took off Kyle Rudolph. He took off Mason Rudolph's helmet. Too many Rudolphs in the NFL right now. That's what I find. Took off Mason Rudolph's helmet, ripped it off by the face mask, and then swings it at him and hits him in the head. I know there were other guys involved, but Miles Garrett, there is no way to justify what he did. He's been suspended indefinitely by the NFL. It's at least the rest of this season and postseason if it were to occur for the Cleveland Browns. I thought Baker Mayfield looked great last night after an ugly incident and standing up and saying, this can't happen. He didn't go all teammate on you. He didn't say, well, their guy was doing this, and I'm not sure. I didn't see all. That's not what he did. He said it's unacceptable. He's going to get suspended. We just don't know how long, but we can't do this to ourselves. We can't have anything like this transpire. I thought Baker Mayfield looked very strong in doing that, and that's the kind of response you want from one of the leaders of your organization. So good for him for doing that last night. As for Miles Garrett, we'll see if he gets reinstated for 2020. I think he probably will. We'll see where this goes. I see somebody, Silver and Black Canuck, who's a Raiders fan, sending this in. I don't think it's fair that Rudolph has not received a suspension. By the way, Garrett suspended for the rest of this year. This is pending appeal, which I'm not sure he'll do, but we'll see. Marquise Pouncey gets himself three games. He was involved. He's a Steelers offensive lineman. He's took a couple of swings at Garrett after this happened. He tried to kick him when he was on the ground. So he has a three-game suspension, one-game suspension for another one of the D-linemen from Cleveland. But this comes in from Silver and Black Canuck. I don't think it's fair. Rudolph has not received a suspension or disciplinary action yet. Because I think you should, and I think it was really pathetic of him to go to the media and call Miles Garrett a coward and say he's considering legal action. Again, Miles Garrett's actions completely unacceptable. He should get a suspension. Even worse than Burfict did, he got 12 games, but that's a litany of suspensions leading up to that. But that shouldn't take away from the fact that Rudolph brought this upon himself. No, he didn't. I'll stop it right there before I finish the rest of the text. He did not bring this upon himself. No, he didn't. We've seen players get in fights before. We don't see players get hit in the head with helmets that have been ripped off. That doesn't happen. We've seen guys lose themselves in the emotion of the moment, and despite the fact they're wearing tons of padding and helmets, swing at each other. What are you going to do? You're going to punch the guy in the helmet? We've seen that before because guys just see red and they want to fight. So we've seen that before. But we haven't seen what we saw last night. It's completely unacceptable. It violates every rule of engagement. There are certain situations you know you can get into in physical sports. That's not one of them. That doesn't happen. So, no, Rudolph didn't bring this on himself. Silver and Black Canuck goes on to say he acted like a coward on the field and was a total jackass when the media was involved. You might not have liked what he did, but put yourself in his shoes for a second. This is a guy, by the way, that the helmet that he got hit with last night is not the worst head blow that he has received this season. This is a guy who was out on his feet after a hit against the Ravens earlier this year and fell unconscious onto the turf. This has been a difficult year for Mason Rudolph. But he's been hit in the head with a helmet, something that never happens before. Rivalry game, emotions are running high. You think he's going to go to the podium and say, well, now that I'm settled down, yeah, you know, I take accountability for my part in all this. No chance. I didn't paraphrase and butcher your text, by the way. It was difficult to decipher Silver and Black Canuck. There's some grammatical errors in there, so I did the best I could. If you want to clear it up, you can send it to me. We can answer it offline. Kelly Olynyk was on the program today. I want to get to this story. We're going to talk a lot more about the Canucks game, and we'll get your text into the conversation on Canucks Central just after this. Bick Nizar is going to join me at the top of the hour. Alex Auld will join us at the bottom of the noon hour as well. He'll give you his play of the week. He'll break down what he saw last night, and we'll get his assessment of whether coaching errors were made, because some people seem to be hitting on that. But Kelly Olynyk was on the program earlier today. Seventh year in the NBA, third year with the Miami Heat. He is a guy who has always shown up for Canada. And if you missed the news today, it's big news. Canada has one last shot to qualify for the Olympics on the men's side next summer. And that shot comes in the form of a last chance qualifying tournament. 16 tournament, you got to win it to move on. Well, Canada Basketball stepped up and said, we want to host it. We'll put forth the money, we will run the event. We are hosting it, and it's coming to Victoria. June 23rd to 30th, next summer, Canada gets to play against, I haven't seen the other five teams yet, but win that tournament, you go to the Olympics. So Canada Basketball said, we're going to put our guys in the best possible position here. We'll host this thing. That's one less excuse as to why you can't make it next summer. We're going to give you every opportunity to come compete and put the Canadian jersey on. Kelly Olynyk, I asked him about that. I asked him why, for him, a guy who's always shown up, is it so important to represent our country on the court?
Yeah, definitely the way I was raised. You know, I think, you know, my dad was involved in the national teams. You know, I come from a basketball family, and, you know, just having that opportunity when I was young and, you know, watching those guys play. You know, I remember watching, you know, Steve and Canada in the Sydney Olympics in, what was it, 2000. You know, in my living room with my dad and my family, and you know, being like, you know, I want to do that someday, and you know, just having been a part of it, you know, it's something that, you know, there's not a lot of ways that you can make a difference and truly give back to your country and the place that, you know, that raised you and brought you up and gave you the opportunities to live a wonderful, successful life, and playing for your country and you know, wearing those colors and Canada across your chest with pride is one of those ways that I'm able to do it. So when I have that opportunity, I don't shy away.
Not every Canadian has shown up as often as you. How disappointed are you when that happens, or do you understand that each situation is unique?
Each situation is definitely unique. I mean, whether you're nursing injuries or, you know, your career or your contracts are at stake, or whatever, sometimes there's other, you know, factors that play into it, whether it's, you know, family stuff or, you know, different stuff that's going on. You know, everybody, you know, has their rhymes and reasons. And I think for, you know, for some guys, it means a little more. And for other guys that they, you know, they have to take care of other stuff first. And I don't hate on them or, get on them for not playing, because people have their reasons and, you know, they're entitled to those.
Kelly Olynyk, Canadian basketball player with the Miami Heat, joins us here on the Scott Rintoul Show. How close is the Canadian fraternity in the NBA?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely close. There's a lot of guys now in the NBA, and there's a bunch of young guys coming up who are now getting in this league and this association and making some noise. And it's amazing to see. When I got drafted, it was, there's maybe a few of us, handful of us, but it's grown and grown and grown, and it's unbelievable to see, where it's come from, where it's going to, and it's just going to keep getting better. I mean, there's talent coming out of Canada, by the dozens, and these guys are legit top talents in college basketball, in high school first, and then college basketball, and then now you're seeing guys make serious noise in the NBA.
So today's news, and I'm not sure if you knew about this before the news came down today about Canada hosting this tournament, will that cause you to text some of the guys that you might be playing with? Will this be a big deal among Canadian NBAers?
No, I think it definitely makes it easier to play. It's hard. This last summer, you had to, a 30-hour trip to Australia and then flying all over Australia and then going to China. It's taxing, especially when you're getting back 3 days before training camp starts, and then you're going into training camp and then, starting an NBA season. It's not easy. And, I think with that tournament in Canada, we can stay in Canada, train in Canada. You know where you're staying is a good place. You know, with the food you're eating is going to be all right with your body and your system. You can get your workouts in or whatever. It's easier for, NBA teams to send some guys up to keep tabs on you and help you with whatever they need from their side. It just makes it, a more streamlined, seamless process. And, I knew there was an opportunity that it would be there, but, we've heard mumblings that there was opportunities that other, tournaments would be in Canada too, and they didn't come to fruition. So whatever it was that made this one, come to life, I'm super grateful, and my only hope and wish is that I'm healthy and ready enough to to step out there and make sure that we get to Tokyo.
Important for him, and I'm glad to hear it, and I hope that rubs off on enough other people around this team. There are a lot of guys that didn't show up this past summer, and it was disappointing. And well, as Kelly Olynyk talks about, you can understand it in certain individual situations. They have eliminated as many excuses as possible, and they being Basketball Canada. We're hosting the event. You're not going to get a better opportunity. You want to qualify for the Olympics? You want to go do something that Steve Nash did and turned a lot of young Canadians on in this country to this sport, in addition to what he was doing in the NBA? Well, we're going to give you the best chance. And I love the fact that Basketball Canada recognizes what is at stake here, and also the momentum this sport has in this country. With everything that happened regarding the attention on the Raptors run, and then the draft where RJ Barrett is the latest Canadian to go in the top five, and a nice start to the season here for a number of young Canadians. Andrew Wiggins playing the best basketball of his NBA career right now. Basketball Canada said, okay, the moment is now. We need to be in the Olympics next summer. We'll step up. Let's make this happen. Now, it's on the players. Now it's on the players to show up. And if you are legitimately injured, no one's going to hold that against you. If you have something massive in your life from a personal standpoint, I'm not saying it has to be exactly like what Jacob Markstrom is going through right now, but if you have something of that magnitude in your life that you're going through, yes, everybody can relate and sympathize and empathize and say, okay, I get it. Beyond that, time to show up. Time to show up for this country. They've stepped up for the players. Now the players have to step up. and I know the crowds are going to be sensational. This is going to be an excellent event. I'm fired up about this news today. Great to have Kelly Olynyk on. You can hear that interview in its entirety, sportsnet.ca/650. Time to make way for Canucks Central. What is Alex Auld's play of the week? And what should the Canucks learn from what happened last night against the Dallas Stars? That's all on the way next here on your home of hockey, your home of the Vancouver Canucks, Sportsnet 650.